You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
Something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
So, how I look at it is you have the secret societal system that's able through different people, through different organizations, is able to affect change within different countries. And they play countries against each other. They do all kinds of things. Their end game is to rule the world through China, these secret societies.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Chris Milligan. Today's show, Skull and Bones, Secrecy and Our Republic. Chris Milligan is a publisher, writer, and musician. His father was in the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, Military Intelligence, G2, and later in the CIA, rising to branch chief, head of intelligence analysis for East Asia. His father told him things he didn't understand in the late 1960s. These revelations led to over 40 years of research into the subject of CIA drugs, clandestine operations, and secret societies. His publishing house, Trine Day, brought Anthony Sutton's America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones, to a wider audience. He started Trine Day in 2000 as a vehicle to get suppressed books into wider circulation. With no shortage of spiked materials, Trine Day has grown to over 100 volumes in print and has succeeded in achieving a wider distribution for suppressed works. He edited and is a contributing author of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society.
Chris Milligan, welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, Bonnie.
In the preface to your anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society, you write that, quote, this book started as research into trying to understand some things my dad told me. Who was your father? Could you take us through his history with intelligence?
Well, his name was Lloyd Milligan, and at the age of 18, he was an exchange student to the University of Shanghai. This was in 1936. He started working with the State Department then. The State Department asked him to gather anything that he could about the Japanese. He left Shanghai a week before the Japanese bombed it, went up to Vladivostok, went across the Trans-Siberian Railway through Moscow to Vienna, then went up to Berlin, and then finally ended up in 1937 at the World Council of Churches with the Dulles brothers. And then he went back to school, graduated in 1939. He was supposed to go to a school in Switzerland for study on international relations, but the war, World War II, had started. And he ended up, got as far as the basement of the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C., where he was working under Archibald MacLeish, who was a member of the Order of Skull and Bones. While he was there, they gave him the Philippines desk, told him to become a expert on the Philippines. He was in William Donovan's, Wild Bill Donovan's first organization, COI, Coordinator of Information. Then he went from there to OSS. And then when he was in OSS, he got drafted in World War II. And OSS said, great, you're still going to be working for OSS, but we're going to put you into the military. We do not trust General MacArthur and one of his aides, Colonel Willoughby, and they wanted him to spy on them and also to gather anything that was printed within the Japanese-controlled Philippines at that time. The gentleman, my father, they put him on as the personal and private secretary to a Dr. Hayden. He had been in charge of the Philippines education system, the library system. The United States owned the Philippines. And then when the Japanese invaded the Philippines, Dr. Hayden was working with a bunch of the guerrillas. Dr. Hayden left the Pacific Theater to talk to Roosevelt, came back to the United States. He died when he was in the United States. They took my dad out of theater and then sent him back to the Philippines to pick up the paperwork that Dr. Hayden had. And then he went back to the Philippines and started working a lot with the guerrillas, worked with the guerrillas, went with them into Manila way before the American troops. He sequestered the Japanese puppet government's library and papers. He got sued by the Japanese government for that and got given a Legion of Merit by the American government for that. And when MacArthur finally arrived into the Philippines, into Manila, he found a bunch of his friends in jail because MacArthur had been raised in the Philippines. His father, Arthur MacArthur, was the first military governor that they sent over there during the Spanish-American War. And there's a very thin oligarchy in the Philippines, and so these were his, MacArthur's friends that were in jail, and he didn't like that, and he said to get rid of my father. They moved my father then from the Philippines to being head of research and analysis for the invasion of Japan, and they had to get somebody in to replace him into the Philippines, and that person had to be both in OSS and in military intelligence, G2, and there was very few of those people around, and the person they got was a gentleman by the name of Edwin Lansdale. And he was very much an interesting person. My father started working with him in psychological warfare during World War II. Then my father got given a special aegis between VJ Day and his muster. And that was, he was supposed to write a special report on the Japanese use of heroin and opium before and during World War II. Then he went back to D.C., went through a couple of alphas, and was in CIA when it began. His last overt job in CIA was branch chief, head of all of East Asia Analysis Office. Then in 1951, he went covert. They needed somebody. My dad was a rather liberal guy. He was from the West Coast. They needed somebody to go talk to Sukarno in Indonesia. And so they sent my dad and actually myself and my brother and sister and my mom as a family to go with him to Indonesia. And then he came back to the United States. And what he told me later on, as kids, we were told he had a job as a advertising salesman for the Glen Falls Sun Echo around D.C., but actually what he was doing, he was helping to write the what's now known as the PDB, the President's Daily Briefing. He explained to me that he called it a newspaper that they helped write for the president and the generals every morning. And then in 1956, he was sent to the Far East. Again, he met with Lansdale in Vietnam. And he must have written a report because Lansdale was soon recalled. And then my dad ran into some interference, and he told me he left the agency soft in 57 and then left him hard in 59. In 1957, he got all of a sudden he went from being a part-time speechwriter for a senator and other things to becoming a vice president of a college in Nashville. And then, like I say, he... In 1959, he was asked to be president of the college. The president had quit. He said no and left and moved the whole family out to Oregon. And he later told me in 1969, when he took me into a room with a Dr. D.F. Fleming from Vanderbilt, that he had quit them in 59. That's one reason he was talking to me in 69, because he... had signed a piece of paper, said he couldn't talk for 10 years. And I thought about it later, and it didn't make much difference, I thought, because nobody would believe what he had to say.
So your father was working for intelligence in some very big hot spots, Philippines, Vietnam, Indonesia. You mentioned the rebels in the Philippines. Now, were you referring to Philippine rebels that were going up against the Japanese, or just
the Japanese? Yes. He was working with the guerrillas that were going against the Japanese. There's a book that he edited, written by Hernando Abaya, who was a major Philippine journalist. It's called "Betrayal of the Philippines."
A friend of mine has told me, and I wanted to ask you about this, that with regard to Ed Lansdale's work in the Philippines, that somehow guerrilla groups in the Philippines were either infiltrated or directed or whatever, and then wiped out eventually. Like they were... Do you know anything about this?
Well, there was a quote-unquote communist insurgency, the HUK, or I don't know how you pronounce it, H-U-K-S. And Lansdale ran a campaign. It was mostly Psy War. It was mostly false battles, and where they would say there's a big to-do, and then he would take his guy, who he ended up getting elected as a president, Raymond McGoosey, or I can't say his name either, would be the big hero. And it was mostly a false battle campaign. And they would do things such as to scare the people. They would kill a body and drain all the blood out and tell the people there was vampires and stuff like this.
Well, now, was this a campaign in order to turn the general population against the rebels, or was it to figure out who they were so they could be wiped out?
Yeah, a little bit of both. You know, a little bit of both. But the biggest thing was a stage show to get the guy that he wanted elected president.
Yes, okay. Now, you mentioned that you and your whole family went to Indonesia. Now, what was going on? Well, now, eventually, the head of Indonesia that your father was meeting with, he was overthrown, right?
Absolutely, yes.
Yes, that was a very, very bloody and horrifying overthrow. What do you think your father's mission there was?
Well, Sukarno had just consolidated power and had just, you know, come up with the country of Indonesia. It had been owned by the Dutch. And this was after World War II, and the colonies were, you know, going away. And so, and he was a, you know, he was for the people and stuff like that. So they needed somebody liberal that he could talk to. And so they sent my dad to talk to him and help set up a relationship with Sukarno.
Right. And then Sukarno was overthrown by Suharto, right?
Yes. And see, we left in 52, right at the end of 52. And then my dad came back, and he had already, he just stayed covert. And what he told me was that's basically when he started to write what's now known as the PDB, right? Be part of the group that wrote that. And because before then, he'd been branch chief head of all of East Asia analysis office.
Well, was he writing the presidential daily briefings from Indonesia?
No, no. We came back to the United States and lived in Fairfax. We were only in Indonesia for about 2 years.
I see. And then when was Sukarno overthrown by, I get these names mixed up. What is it?
Sukarno and Suharto, right.
When was he?
After the Sikh members. Sukarno tried to do, he had the Bandung meeting, and they were going to have a third world line between, you know, you'd have the commies and the capitalists, and then you would have this third world, which was all the other powers trying to get together to be a thing. And then also there's the situation of the gold. And I strongly recommend people to read a book called Gold Warriors by Sterling Seagrave. He is the son of Thomas Seagrave, the Burma surgeon. He was raised in Southeast Asia. Most of his books were Book of the Month Club and New York Times bestsellers until he wrote Gold Warriors. He got so many death threats that he moved to France, and he had to publish it himself. There is a edition that has come out from Verso out of England, but it just, if you read it, I mean, your jaw just drops. And Lansdale's a big part of it. MacArthur's a big part of it. Nixon's a part of it. But you see, the Japanese had a thing called Operation Golden Lily that started in the 30s. And they would go through Korea and China, and they would go into every little village and big towns and say, give us your gold. And they stuck around for, you know, some of these places for almost 10 years. And so they would get the easy gold, and they, later on, and there was this huge amount of gold and precious gems that were stashed in Indonesia, Burma, and most of it in the Philippines. And Lansdale, 10 days after he arrived in the Philippines, ended up doing an interrogation on somebody that led him to this gold. And this gold's a big part. We gave a whole bunch of it back to China. And then there was a bunch of this gold that was used to finance CIA operations and other things.
So approximately how long was it after you and your family left Indonesia that Sukarno was overthrown?
Off the top of my head, I'm going to say about 10 years. Seems to me it was right around 1960, but I don't know.
Okay, well then it was a substantial amount of time as well.
It was a substantial amount of time.
Okay, you know,
My dad wasn't involved with that.
Right.
He became aware of the drug trade, and that was his big reason for leaving. He just would not stand for it. He wouldn't have anything to do with it.
Was this, are you referring to Indonesia or Vietnam?
Vietnam.
I see.
Vietnam.
When was your father in Vietnam, and what was he doing there? And you were there as well, right?
No. This was 1956. We were left at home and told that father was going to be writing this book on the church in Southeast Asia, and we were taken to our grandparents' house in Oregon. And he met with Lansdale at a little town called Toi Ninh, Vietnam, the home of Cao Dao, which is a secret society. And it was how I found out. Well, I knew about the trip when I was a little kid, and then my dad died in 1990, and I was in the midst of doing a lot of heavy research on a subject I call CIA drugs. And one of the things I was trying to find out, because I'd been told that Chiang Mai, Thailand, which is the second largest city in Thailand and is basically a heroin city, there's a four-lane highway straight to the Golden Triangle, and all the big banks have branches there, that it had been a small little village in my lifetime, and it's now the second largest city, and I was trying to find out information. and I couldn't. And then I was having a hard time. And then after my dad died, I'm going through his papers, and I see in this 1956 trip, his itinerary, he'd been in Chiang Mai, Thailand. And I say, great, I can go speak with my mother about this. And so next time I see my mom, I visit home, I ask her, Mom, how big was Chiang Mai, Thailand? She says, oh, it wasn't very big. Probably the biggest thing in town is the church. I've got some pictures of it. So I'm reaching up right next to where she's sitting is her bookcase with her picture books in it. And I'm pulling down the picture book from that time. And she says, and that's when I stopped believing everything I read in the newspapers. And my mother was a very good CIA wife. I would ask her questions all the time, and she would say, I don't know anything. And because my dad was very sick for the last 10 years of his life. I really couldn't talk to him much. She says, well, that's when I stopped believing everything I read in the newspapers. And I says, what do you mean? She says, well, they'd been in Vietnam, and they'd gone from there to Bangkok and then to Chiang Mai. And she said the big story in the Thai papers was about this big battle in Vietnam, right where they had been. She said there was no battle. We were having a picnic. And so I turned the picture page, a couple pages, and there's my dad talking to Lansdale in Vietnam. And then there's this beautiful picture of my mother, I ended up showing it to my siblings later on, and it became one of the main pictures of her memorial because she's just vivacious in it. And she's sitting there, and her skirt's kind of twirling, and you can see sitting on the ground over there, there's Lansdale, and they're having a picnic. And there's these people with fatigues and those little Australian-type ranger hats walking around, and I look at the caption that my mother had written down, and it says, out from Saigon with Colonel Lansdale and North Vietnamese military leaders. And so in doing my research, in 1955, okay, we took over Vietnam after Dien Bien Phu in 1954. Okay, in 1955, Lansdale, because the French intelligence and the Corsican Mafia were still running the Golden Triangle, and at Lansdale asked them to leave, and they said, "Well, no." And so there was a shooting war, and this is Gerald Posner's, one of his first books talks about it. This is one of the very few shooting wars between Western intelligence agencies. And we went up there and took over the Golden Triangle. And so this is right after, so my dad gets there in 56. And also you can read about Lansdale going up into Vietnam and bringing down a whole bunch of people from North Vietnam. It was all Vietnam at that time. And, what my dad told me in 1969 with the professor from Vanderbilt, he opened up his mouth. The first words he said was, Vietnam War is about drugs. There's these secret societies behind it. I'm thinking he's talking about the mafia. It's the only thing I could think of. And this is 1969. And then he tells me, and communism's all a sham. These same secret societies are behind it all. It's all a big game. And at that point in time, I think my dad's nuts. And I'm a teenager in this late 60s. I know more about drugs than he does. And then this little light bulb comes on in my head and says, oh, he's having the drug talk with me. He hadn't had the other one. I was married and had a six-month-old kid. So I start to straighten up, and I'm, getting ready to say yes, sir, and all this, and waiting for my dad to tell me to stop smoking pot. And he doesn't. He tells me all about his intelligence career. And then they start talking about how they're playing out a loose scenario in Vietnam. And then they start talking about psychological warfare and sway pieces. And it soon becomes apparent that I have no idea what they're talking about. Okay? But so this meeting in 56 that my dad had with Lansdale, for my money, he was right on, because they took American boys and girls and sent them to hell for 1 year. And then those boys and girls, some of them got addicted to the heroin that was being proffered to them by anybody who was 12 years and up. And then what does a junkie do? A junkie sells junk. And you take these boys and girls that are come there from all across America and send some of them back as junkies, because what I've determined is, you know, and what my dad told me, too, he actually told me this before the meeting with the professor. He told me one time, he says, they're out to opiate your whole generation. And this was the first time I'd ever heard the word opiate. I knew what it meant. And I remember telling him, I says, listen, I never see that stuff. I don't lie. I just smoke a little pot. And he came back at me and he says, well, I don't care. You're still making money for them. And the way he spat out them, I knew he didn't like them. And so it was, and also the other thing is right after that, my dad came back. Lansdale was recalled from Vietnam. So I've figure my dad wrote a report. It wasn't very good, and Lansdale then was recalled. And there are people who say Lansdale was in Dealey Plaza that day, and for my money, he was the scriptwriter of the Kennedy assassination.
Well, yes, there's a very famous picture taken in Dealey Plaza in the aftermath of the assassination of President Kennedy that clearly shows what Fletcher Prouty said is Ed Lansdale walking down the street. The view is from behind, but the characteristic twist of his hand identifies him. This, according to Fletcher Prouty, and of course, it's one of the many pictures of the three tramps.
Right, right. And there was also a general who was very familiar with Lansdale that concurred with that. And, you know, where did Lansdale come from? I live out in Oregon, and there was happened to be the town I live in, Eugene. Outside Eugene, there was his nephew, Ed Lansdale's nephew, lived here for many years. And we used to get together and talk, and we figured that Ed was an advertising guy from San Francisco, and there was the possibility that he had been connected with some of the occult groups in San Francisco. And that was one way that he got involved, because, again, I look at this through what my daddy told me and the secret societies. And for what my research has shown, at the end of the day, that's who the ruling bodies are, is through the secret societal network.
Well, there you have it. Publisher Chris Milligan talking about his father's intelligence career, beginning in the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, Military Intelligence G2, and later in the CIA, rising to branch chief, head of intelligence analysis for East Asia. Some of his stations were in the Philippines, Japan, Vietnam, and Indonesia, locations of great upheaval in the 20th century. Most, if not all of it, orchestrated by the powerful, and so many of these powerful are members of secret societies. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, we are offering, as a thank you gift, for a donation of $100, tax deductible, of course, a copy of this 712-page anthology, Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. This volume is, of course, edited and published by Chris Milligan, whom you've just been listening to. You can support the Pacifica Network and KPFA Radio by making that $100 donation by calling 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-439-5732. 5732 and asking for a copy of this jam-packed anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society, which includes contributions by Anthony Sutton, Howard Altman, Chris Milligan, Dr. Ralph Bunch, Anton Chaikin, Webster Tarpley, and many more. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org and click on the link to books. It's a great premium, but of course, the real premium is commercial-free radio, where you can hear content right on your radio, not available anywhere else on the dial. Please support Pacifica Radio Network, which is our country's last bastion of commercial-free community radio, with no corporate or foundation funding, except for Democracy Now, of course. The Pacifica Radio Network provides commercial-free content for hundreds of community radio stations across the country. And I know a lot about that because the Pacifica Audio Port is where I post Guns and Butter, and I can see little stations across the country downloading those shows. So the Pacifica Network is so very important, not just for the five big stations that are part of Pacifica, but for the content that the Pacifica Radio Network provides to all of these smaller community radio stations and college stations. It's so very important for you to support Pacifica and KPFA. A tax-deductible $100 donation today will get you this extraordinary 712-page anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. Chris Milligan, the publisher and contributing author, told me that he edited this volume to act as a reference guide, and it is jam-packed with history. It's a huge book, and you can pick it up in any different chapter you like by any different author. It's got an incredible table of contents. Fleshing Out Skull and Bones features 42 chapters from a dozen plus authors, plus many historical articles providing a wide array of viewpoints into this very secret organization whose members increasingly affect world events. Chapter titles include the September 11th attack, the War on Terror, and the Order of Skull and Bones. Geronimo's Bones by Howard Altman. That's a controversial subject. Actually, I think at one point, maybe even presently, I'm not sure, the descendants of Geronimo are suing Yale University. I don't know where that stands. Secrecy and Our Constitution, Whom Do They Serve? By Dr. Ralph Bunch. Prescott Bush, $1,500,000 and Auschwitz by Tony Rogers. The Secret Treaty of Fort Hunt by Carl Oglesby. That's in this anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. Also, The War of 82 by Daniel Hopsiger. Reflections on the Yale Succession by Steve Sewell. The Order of Skull and Bones and Illegal Finance, a study of the analytical framework of conspiracy theory. The House of Bush, Born in a Bank, The Hitler Project, Skull and Bones, The Racist Nightmare at Yale by Webster Griffin Tarpley and Anton Chaikin. Everything You Wanted to Ask But Were Afraid to Know, Black Market Bones, Prescott Bush, the Union Banking Corporation, and the story, The Tomb, Man, Magic, and Yale, etc., etc. Those articles by Chris Mulligan. This is an incredible anthology, over 700 pages, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. Please give us a call. Please support KPFA. A $100 donation will get you this incredible book, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Thank you to those of you who donate today on Guns and Butter, and to those of you who have made a pledge in the past. Chris Milligan publishes all these books that can't get published anywhere else. You know, books that can't find a publisher, which is becoming a bigger problem all the time. So please support Trine Day, Chris Milligan, Guns and Butter, KPFA, and the incredible Pacifica Radio Network. 1-800-439-5732. You can pledge securely online at kpfa.org. Just go online and click on the link to books, and you can find Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. I'd like to get back in just a couple of minutes to some more audio from, I actually had a 90-minute interview with Chris Milligan, and we can't bring you all the audio today, but I've pulled out some clips to play. Also, you will find out about, in this book, son of Skull and Bones co-founder Alfonso Taft, Bonesman William H. Taft is the only man to serve as both President and Chief Justice of the United States. Also, Chief Justice of the United States, Bonesman M.R. Waite, in 1886 declared in two sentences and with no debate that corporations have the rights of a person. That's all included in Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society, an over 700-page anthology, incredible history included, for a $100 donation. Please give us a call right now, 1-800-439-5732. A $25 donation, of course, will make you a member of KPFA for an entire year. And as I have said many times, if everyone who listened to the station pledged $25, we wouldn't even have to fundraise. But, of course, most people who listen don't pledge, so it's always up to those of you who do to keep the station going. And I would also like to encourage a few of you who haven't ever pledged to please pledge today. That would be a great help to KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. $100 gets you Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. $25 makes you a member for a year. And, of course, online at kpfa.org. $100 Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I'm so happy to be on the air to support the Pacifica Radio Network, and I would like to play you a little bit more of the audio of my discussion with Chris Milligan. Erica, why don't we listen to that second track? What do you think?
What first piqued your interest in Skull and Bones at Yale University in particular? Now, obviously, there are a lot of secret societies, but you mainly focused on Skull and Bones. What piqued your interest in Skull and Bones?
Well, you know, my dad mentioned secret societies. He never mentioned Skull and Bones. And it was the thing I found the hardest to find any information about. And basically, during, was it 1988, the George Bush campaign, I came across Anthony Sutton's book, America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones. And that started to make some sense about what my dad had said, because, like I said, I had the hardest time getting my head around, and communism's all a sham, these same secret societies are behind it. And if you look at America's secret establishment, it goes into how they were financing communism and financing Russia and other things. So it started to make some sense. And then when I looked at the people that were in Skull and Bones, I says, yeah, these guys are the main group. Now, there is basically seven secret societies there at Yale, and there's Scroll and Key, Book and Snake. I find Book and Snake very, very interesting. When Skull and Bones was started, you had Yale College and you had Sheffield Scientific School. And you could only join Skull and Bones if you went to Yale College. And so the people at Sheffield Scientific School about 20 years after Yale was founded Book and Snake. And you have such as Bob Woodard's a member of Book and Snake. Brady's a member. Nick Brady, the Treasury Secretary, is a member of Book and Snake. But when I looked at Skull and Bones, they were the most powerful, the oldest secret society.
The Order of Skull and Bones was founded how long ago as a chapter of a secret society based in Germany?
1832 is when it was formed as the Order of Skull and Bones. There are scholars, Masonic scholars, who trace it to Phi Beta Kappa. Phi Beta Kappa was first started at the College of William and Mary. Two offshoots went. One went to Yale and one went to Harvard. Then came along the Revolutionary War. College of William and Mary was shut down. Yale and Harvard kept going. We had our first big anti-Illuminati scare in the late 1790s. And then in the 1820s, we started to have an anti-Masonic movement grew up. And by the 1830s there, it became not very cool to be in a secret society. So first Phi Beta Kappa at Harvard became an open society, and then Phi Beta Kappa in 1832, a bunch of people that were in Phi Beta Kappa formed the Order of Skull and Bones, William Huntington Russell and Alonzo Taft. When you get to that core group, what you find is that they're all related. Skull and Bones is built around the Cabot family, with a big, strong subset of the Whitney family.
And some of the parts of Fleshing Out Skull and Bones that you've written, you go into an analysis or an explication of these different familial groups within Skull and Bones. I mean, there were the Bundys, and apparently McGeorge Bundy, his brother and his father were Skull and Bones, and McGeorge Bundy was in many, many administrations, including President Kennedy's, and he was really undercover for the intelligence agencies, wasn't he?
Yeah, they were CIA also. And, yeah, McGeorge is an interesting guy. He helped cause the Bay of Pigs situation.
That's right. He contramanded, I just discovered, President Kennedy's order to support the Bay of Pigs, and the flights were called off by McGeorge Bundy and then blamed on President Kennedy, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the whole Bush family, they're in there. I mean, there's so many people that we're familiar with in powerful positions that come out of Skull and Bones. It's actually quite amazing in your book.
Well, and it continues. The Black Something group that, what's his name, Steve Swarthmore, he's Skull and Bones. They own Sears and Kmart now. Your Treasury Secretary Mnuchin is Skull and Bones.
I did an interview with Webster Griffin Tarpley on events leading up to World War I. According to Webster Tarpley, secret societies and fraternal lodges in many different European countries played major roles in alliances and events causing World War I. In your research, have you found that members of secret societies have wielded extraordinary power in causing conflagrations?
Oh yeah, yeah. They help cause them. They'll sell arms to both sides, and then you find them at the peace treaties too, helping make sure that there'll be another war.
Now, the book that your Hollywood colleague was trying to make a movie out of, or whatever he was trying to do, which book that you published was that?
Well, Franklin Scandal was one. Another was Dr. Mary's Monkey, and another was A Terrible Mistake, the story of Frank Olson.
Yes. So several of the books that you have published, and by the way, of course, you publish books that can't get published anywhere else, but several of these books that you've published, people have attempted, I mean, real movie producers have attempted to produce movies, and they've been prevented, right?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I was in Beverly Hills at the Four Seasons talking with the people that owned the Terminator franchise. I mean, you know, and they had already had a contract. They were going to make a blockbuster movie, $120 million movie on the Bilderberg Group. And I met with them, and I says, well, you know, you might have some political problems. And they says, well, once our latest movie is out in the video game, we'll have so much money in our bucket it won't make any difference. And they did announce in Madrid, where the author of the Bilderberg movie was, that they were going to make a $120 million blockbuster movie about the Bilderberg Group. And then in less than 6 weeks, that company was bankrupt and went out on the Internet. And it says, gosh, we really don't know what happened. They still have their money.
Now, one of the big contributors to your book, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, of course, is Dr. Anthony C. Sutton. And I read some of his contributions to your anthology. In 1968, the Hoover Institute at Stanford University published Western Technology and Soviet Economic Development by Anthony Sutton. According to your book, Anthony Sutton's research and publications claimed that the majority of the Soviet Union's large industrial enterprises had been built with the United States' help or technical assistance. Now, you met Anthony Sutton, didn't you?
Yes.
His background is really very impressive. I couldn't believe it. I guess he was born in the UK. He had this incredible education, and he worked in all of these very heavy-duty industries, mining, steel, etc., and then went on for more education at UCLA, Stanford. Did you work much with him?
I had the great pleasure of meeting him and working with him the last couple years of his life, yes. And he was working at the Hoover Institute, and they asked him to write that book on the Western economics and the Soviet technology. And he had published the first two books. It's a series of three books. And when he got to the third volume, which was in the late 60s, they said, oh, well, no, we don't want to publish that one right now. And Anthony, you know, he was a, what do you call it, naturalized U.S. citizen. And, you know, to do that, you have to read your Constitution. And so he was very aware of the Constitution, and he didn't quite understand this. And so he kept talking to him. Then they said, well, Anthony, don't break your rice bowl. And he broke his rice bowl. He went ahead, and because they wouldn't allow him to publish the third part. And so he went around them and published it as national suicide. Because basically what his research had shown was that the war material that the Russians were sending to the North Vietnamese, because the North Vietnamese were not backed by China. They were backed by Russia, so much so that China would not allow trains to go across China from Russia to Vietnam. And so he found that almost all the war material was made in conjunction with U.S. technology, sometimes even U.S. plants that were ordered through Italy that were set up in Russia to make the war material so that the North Vietnamese could fight us in the Vietnam War. And so that was his first revelation. So he got fired from the Hoover Institute there at Stanford for doing that. And so then he started to write what are his Wall Street books. He wrote Wall Street and FDR, Wall Street and the Bolshevik Revolution, and Wall Street and FDR and Hitler. And then after he had written those books, somebody called him up and says, hey, would you like a list of people in Skull and Bones? And he said, sure. And they sent them out to him. He had to return the thing in 24 hours. And so he copied it and put it in a box underneath his desk. And he told me, he says, after a while, he would sit there and he kicked this box. And he said, oh, yeah. And he looked into it. And he says, oh, well, these are a bunch of the people that he'd been writing about. So he then started to write these little booklets about Skull and Bones, and he could find nobody to publish them here. So he found a publisher in Australia that would publish them. But then they started getting stolen off the docks. And at this point in time, there was no internet, and he had a newsletter. And some people on his newsletter said, what do you mean nobody will publish them? And this was a mom-and-pop print shop up in Montana, so they started publishing his books. And I had sent them letters to them, but I'd never heard back from them. And finally, I started writing about Skull and Bones, and I started trying to get magazines, and nobody would touch it. And finally, I found High Times, and High Times wrote an article, and then the internet came around. I put it up online, and Anthony just sent me an email one day, and we became friends.
Well, Anthony Sutton is a very important writer, a researcher, and our gift today, the anthology Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Society, includes a lot of the writings of Anthony Sutton, many of which I have read, and it's a fascinating read. He knew a lot about technology, hands-on, working in heavy industries, and he could put the lie to the very popular claim in the United States that the Russians were ahead of us, that the Russians were a competitor, that they're going to get ahead of us. And this was all not true. As a matter of fact, you can read in Fleshing Out Skull and Bones that Henry Kissinger himself, over the very strenuous objections from the U.S. Department of Defense, transferred high-level military technology to the Soviet Union so that they could build their missiles. Very interesting, very little known. There is an awful lot in this 700-page anthology, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society. Our thank you gift today for a tax-deductible pledge of $100 to KPFA. Please give us a call, 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. I, of course, am Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter you're listening to, that we come to you every Wednesday from 1 to 2 p.m. And I have two co-producers, Tony Rango and Yaro Mako, who has been with me from the very beginning. We're asking for your support for the content that we bring you every week on Guns and Butter, your support for KPFA, your support for publisher Chris Milligan. My gosh, he's got 100 titles in print, and these are books that can't get printed anywhere else. His publishing firm, Trine Day, is very much like Free Speech Radio Pacifica Network. 1-800-439-5732, $100 for this incredible anthology, really, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Society, Secret Society. And, of course, there's a lot more in here than just about Skull and Bones. There's a whole history of the United States, history of secret societies. There's articles on all kinds of different subjects. It's a great, great thank you gift. I can't recommend it highly enough. You can also pledge securely online at kpfa.org. If you want one of the books, either Fleshing Out Skull and Bones or Portrait of a Scoundrel by Chauncey Holt, just click on the link on the KPFA website to books, and they're all listed there. KPFA.org. I want to thank everyone who has been calling, who supports the Pacifica Network, who supports KPFA, who supports Guns and Butter. A $25 pledge makes you a member for a year. Those $25 pledges are very important to the station. 1-800-439-5732. Now, if you'll remember the presidential election in 2004, will it be Bonesman Bush or Bonesman Kerry in 2004? And I think everybody probably has seen that sort of very funny short clips of who was then the host of Meet the Press. Confronting both George W. Bush, who was president at the time, and John Forbes Kerry about their involvement in Skull and Bones. And, of course, they wouldn't say anything. They said that it was a very big secret. I wanted to get that audio to play for you today, but I didn't have a chance to do it. Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. There are 100 photographs and illustrations in this book. Rare reprints of Bones memorabilia, a complete list of known members sorted alphabetically and by class, and extensive biographical materials, the Deer Island Club Handbook, hard-to-find historical articles, and corporate records. There is a lot in this book. Our thank you gift today on Guns and Butter for a $100 tax-deductible pledge, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones, Investigations into America's Most Powerful Secret Society, with Anthony Sutton, Howard Altman, Chris Milligan, Dr. Ralph Bunch, Anton Chaykin, and Webster Griffin Tarpley, only some of the many authors that have contributed to this incredible book. $100 to support our radio station, and to get this very incredible book. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Securely online at kpfa.org. And I want to thank everyone who has called today, who has pledged. 1-800-439-5732. It's really a very nice book. Lots of illustrations. It's a very interesting read. Of course, I haven't gotten nearly halfway through it. 1-800-439-5732. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. I want to thank again everyone who has pledged, and I would like to encourage everyone who hasn't to maybe consider making a tax-deductible donation to KPFA at 1-800-439-5732. Fleshing Out Skull and Bones features 42 chapters from a dozen-plus authors, plus many historical articles, providing a wide array of viewpoints into this very secret organization whose members increasingly affect world events. Boy, that is an understatement. I hope you've enjoyed hearing Chris Milligan talk about his father and all of the revelations that his father has made. I found it very, very interesting. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. You can get a hold of me at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Please visit gunsandbutter.org, and you can listen to a lot of the past shows that are archived. I've got less than 1 minute to go, and I'm hoping to get maybe even two more of you on the phone to support KPFA at 1-800-439-5732.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Phyllis Bennis on the many wars in Syria, and why the only sane response is to stop fighting them and try diplomacy. I hope you'll stay tuned. Phyllis Bennis came out to Boston on the 13th of October, 2016. She gave a fine talk titled, Ending the Many Wars in Syria. The many wars now all going on at once, that is, even as we speak. Some of these are proxy wars, between Saudi Arabia and Iran, for example. But as Bennis reminds us, these wars between other countries are being fought to the last Syrian. Phyllis Bennis is a writer and activist, a staunch progressive, and she's a very fine public speaker. I really like listening to her, and I trust you will too. Bennis has a particular interest in U.S. foreign policy, especially U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. In a recent talk on New World Notes, she described herself as a middle-class Jewish girl from California. Even so, she is known as an outspoken critic of the foreign and domestic policies of Israel and an advocate for Palestinian rights. But today, her focus is on neither country, but a bit farther to the northeast, on Syria. Which is not to say that Israel and Palestine are irrelevant to the ongoing crisis in Syria. Bennis is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, that very good progressive think tank in Washington, D.C. She spoke at Emmanuel College in Boston on October 13. Emmanuel College is new to me. Turns out it's a small Catholic liberal arts college, and it has a student group called Emmanuel College Peace Action, who helped sponsor Bennis's visit. Hats off to them. Hats off also to Massachusetts Peace Action, which co-sponsored the talk. Which made me think, where the heck is Connecticut Peace Action? No such critter, apparently. Even Google never heard of it. We have heard of Phyllis Bennis, though, and now we'll hear the first half of Bennis's Boston talk, and the rest next week. Ending the many wars in Syria. Here is Phyllis Bennis.
Well, thanks to Emmanuel and to Emmanuel Peace Action. This is a great chance to, I haven't been to Emmanuel before, so this is a great chance to see the school. And it's, I think, an important time for folks to be coming together to talk about the war in Syria and what it's a part of, the broader war that it's one part of, because things are going from bad to worse. Things are not getting better. And left to their own devices, our government and other governments are pretty sure to do the wrong thing rather than the right thing most of the time when it comes to these wars. So I think it's an important time to be talking about it. You know, it's difficult in a certain way to talk about the war in Syria, because the war in Syria is not a war, and it's not only in Syria, but it's part of a global war. We could identify what President Bush called the global war on terror, and the war that's raging in Syria is part of that war. The other complication is that the war in Syria is not a single war. The war in Syria is about 8 or 9 or 10 separate wars divided into two sections. So there's a civil war going on between the Syrian regime and part of its population that began, as you know, in the context of the Arab Spring in with a nonviolent uprising for asking for political reforms, quickly militarized when the regime clamped down with enormous brutality, was answered with a newly militarized movement, and morphed fairly quickly into civil war. But separate from that, there's a whole host of proxy wars being waged in Syria, whether it's between Saudi Arabia and Iran, who are looking for who's going to be the regional hegemon in terms of oil and military power and economic power and political power, and in terms of a sectarian war also between Iran and Saudi Arabia, whether Sunni or Shia Islam is going to be dominant in the region. Then there's wars of other forces. There's a war between the U.S. and Israel against Iran for all kinds of things. There's a war between the religious or and many of them extremist, but not all, and the secular forces within the opposition. There's several wars between Turkey and the Kurds, and there's struggles between various Kurdish forces. All of these are being waged to the last Syrian, but most of them don't have anything to do with Syria and will not do any good for anybody in Syria. There's also a war going on that has been a Cold War up until now, but is rapidly heating up. And that's the war between the United States and Russia, which is getting worse and worse in Syria. And we're hearing very dangerous developments just in the last few days. The good news is that Secretary of State Kerry is trying once again to get talks underway. There's some plans for talks in Lausanne in Switzerland on Saturday. Nobody is too optimistic about those talks. And in the midst of those talks, we're also hearing about new escalations on all sides, military moves that are quite threatening when there's no talks underway and no easy way out for either of these giant superpowers overarmed with military and particularly nuclear weapons. So there's some very dangerous developments underway. And the urgency, therefore, for reaching some kind of negotiated ceasefire, arms deal, arms control, and ultimately diplomatic solution becomes more urgent than ever. So the context of all this, and I'll get into a little bit of the detail, not too much, but the context of it all is what President Bush called the global war on terror. Now, you remember, some of you, most of you are too young to remember, but you've probably read about it. After 9/11, the day after, even the day of, we heard from President Bush there was a choice, that Americans had a choice. We could either go to war or let them get away with it. It was war or nothing. And since most people didn't want to just say, let them get away with it, do nothing, a lot of people supported war who might otherwise have been against it. Why would they have been against it? Well, to start with, none of the hijackers were from Afghanistan. None were Afghans. They were mainly Saudis and a couple of Egyptians. They didn't live in Afghanistan. They lived in Hamburg. They didn't train in Afghanistan. They trained in Florida. They didn't go to flight school in Afghanistan. They went to flight school in Minnesota. So what were we doing bombing Afghanistan? Because they were inspired by somebody who was holed up in Afghanistan. But we also know that a big part of the reason for the war in Afghanistan, aside from revenge, despite the rhetoric, this was never a war for justice. This was a war for revenge. But it was also a war to prepare the political ground for a war in Iraq. Now, why? Because there were weapons of mass destruction. Oh, no, that's wrong. It's because Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11. Oh, no, that's not quite right. Except a lot of people in this country still think that's true because we were told it over and over and over again by people in Washington who most people in this country like to assume knew something more than we knew, had access to more information than we knew or some version thereof. So the global war on terror is launched. And what we see is that the U.S. has been at war with terrorism for 15 years, and terrorism is doing just fine. Terrorism is thriving. The people and the cities and the countries where this so-called war against terrorism is being waged, they're not doing so well. People are being killed. Cities are being destroyed. The levels of instability and violence and chaos have escalated throughout an enormous and expanding region. Now, to his credit, and it's about the only thing I want to give him credit for here, President Bush understood what he was doing, and he called it a global war, exactly what it was. President Obama, when he was elected on a platform of ending what he called the dumb war in Iraq and promising, as he did, to expand the smart war in Afghanistan, something he did, that was a promise kept. I think too many people sort of skipped that part when they were looking at his anti-war credentials and saying, great, he's going to end the war in Iraq and not looking at the other side of it. But on the second day after he came into office, the Obama administration sent out a memo to the White House and to the Pentagon and to the State Department, to, you know, pretty much everybody, saying we would rather that you not call this the global war on terror. We would rather use the term overseas contingency operation. Now, it's pretty Orwellian. You know, it's this anodyne description, overseas operation. It's kind of, you know, the global fire truck getting the kitten out of the tree. When I heard it, I thought, well, that's what you do, like if you send the Navy to rescue people off the coast of Haiti who have been displaced from the hurricane. That's an overseas operation, right? This is a war, and he should call it a war. Now, it's not the same kind of war. It's quite different. It doesn't involve hundreds of thousands of ground troops, as George Bush's war did. But there is no question this is a war. Just ask anybody in Afghanistan or Iraq or Syria or Yemen or Djibouti or Somalia or Libya or any of these countries where these wars are being waged. So what we have is the continuation of a global war on terror, but one that is not identified as a full-scale war, despite the costs to the people and cities and countries where it's being waged, and ultimately the costs here at home in the discrediting of our government and our policies, in the financial costs, which I'll get to later. But we're seeing all of this at a moment when the U.S. is expanding militarism around the world. It isn't only in the war theater of the broader Middle East. It's also the militarization of foreign policy, where extreme sanctions that are crippling for ordinary people and military threats and the escalation of military capacities around the world take the place of a diplomatic focus for diplomacy, for foreign policy. So the irony is, of course, when we look at when, and we're hearing a lot now about President Obama's legacy, he's in his last few months of office, he's thinking about legacies, other people are writing about his legacy. He's got some things to be very proud of that are based on the triumph of diplomacy over war. He can point to the Iran nuclear deal, which was a hard-fought accomplishment against massive opposition in Congress, massive opposition from Israel, massive political opposition. But they got it through, and it's been a remarkably powerful, strong, negotiated deal. It has its problems, but it's avoided what was a potentially devastating war. He can point to Cuba, where after 50 years of crippling sanctions and a blockade, we're not all the way there yet. We don't have full normalization yet. But the U.S. is well on its way towards normalizing relations with Cuba. And all of that was done without firing a shot, eliminating the worst of the sanctions. Not all, but we're on the way. If you look at everywhere where the military has been the centerpiece of our policy, we've failed. And this global war on terror, it didn't just fail in some broad rhetorical sense. Yes, we've been at war with terror for 15 years and terrorism is doing just fine. I kind of like that line. It's quite accurate. But it isn't just that broad framework. It's also the failures you can point to in every one of those countries where that war has been waged. So start with Afghanistan, where we first went to war for the global war on terror. We've been having troops in Afghanistan for almost it'll be 15 and a half years now. You know, it's an extraordinary thing. At the end of the day, what do we see in Afghanistan? We see massive failure. Just last week, the Central Command reaffirmed that as of now, the Taliban controls more territory in Afghanistan than at any time since the U.S. overthrew the Taliban back in 2001. Great. 15 years of occupation have done great. And then you hear, well, at least the girls can go to school. At least children can get an education, which they couldn't under the Taliban. Well, there were plenty of problems under the Taliban. It was a repressive, horrific, misogynistic regime, no doubt. But what we've got now in a government led by corrupt politicians and a bunch of warlords whose own religious and political views are very, very similar to those of the Taliban. We just heard from the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan that over 42% of the children of Afghanistan have either never gone to school, or if they went at all, they were forced to leave school by the fifth grade at the most. Most have gotten no education at all. Why? Because most of the schools that were supposedly being built at enormous expense with our tax money by U.S.-paid contractors were simply never built at all. The few that were often collapsed in the first winter because they weren't built to withstand it, and they have no teachers. So the whole question of how the U.S. tried to operate in Afghanistan has been a fraud. It has accomplished nothing. When the U.S. invaded Afghanistan, Afghanistan was, according to UNICEF, the worst country in the world for a child to be born and survive to her first birthday, and the worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive. Today, it's still the worst country in the world for a woman to, I shouldn't say today, this was about 6 months ago, it may have changed by now, but it was still the worst country in the world for a woman to give birth and survive, and the second worst country in the world, Sierra Leone, came out ahead, if you will. So that's what we have to brag about after 15 years of military occupation. In Iraq, the next, if we go chronologically, the next country for the global war on terror, we see a government that is so incompetent that there is still only 6 or 7 hours of electricity for anybody in Baghdad and 4 or 5 or less for anybody else in the country. They've never been able to get the electricity working again after the war. And so incredibly sectarian as a Shia-dominated government and brutal in its treatment of the large Sunni minority that a ton of Sunni, ordinary Sunni Iraqis are turning to ISIS as the lesser evil. Not because they're extremists, not because they're religious fanatics. I mean, I've met some of these Sunni generals. They are as secular as they come. They drink, they smoke, God knows what else they do. But they are not religious anything. But they are turning to ISIS because they see it as the potential for maybe they could get some support, some defense of their community against a sectarian government put in place, armed and paid by the United States with our tax money, despite the fact that they're more accountable to Iran than they are to us. But that government has been so repressive against ordinary Sunnis, from roundups of young Sunni men on the streets, torture in the prisons, bombing of a Sunni nonviolent protest camp. It's been really grim. So people are turning to ISIS and saying, well, maybe that's where we could get some kind of hope, some kind of support against this government. It's been a complete failure. In Yemen, Yemen's the poorest country in the Arab world, has been for decades. 80% of the population now is completely dependent on food for survival from the United Nations. The economy has been destroyed. People are being held in towns that have been under siege by the Saudi-led coalition that is dropping bombs that we provide from planes that we provide that are fueled in the air by our planes and our pilots. And we read in the New York Times today that for the first time, the U.S. is engaging in the war in Yemen. And I wanted to yell at somebody at the Times and say, what do you think in-air refueling is? Chopped liver? You know, it's like, what are you people thinking? This is the first time. They have been engaged in this war for the entire 15 months this war has been waged. What they did do for the first time today, or I guess yesterday, was to directly bomb the rebel forces in Yemen who are fighting back against the Saudi coalition bombing, who tried to bomb a U.S. warship and failed, and the U.S. went and bombed Yemen and took out 3 targeting things of some sort. I'm not quite sure what they were. Radar systems on the Yemeni coast. So now the U.S. is clearly fully directly involved. It certainly isn't the first time, as I mentioned earlier. But it has been an absolute failure. The Saudi war has led to enormous civilian casualties. You all know about the bombing of the funeral parlor 3-4 days ago now, where 140 people were killed right off the cuff. Another 500 to 600 have been injured, some of them badly enough that they will probably not survive. So the entire escalation of the Saudi war in Yemen is going forward with full U.S. backing, U.S. support. In Libya, again in the context of the Arab Spring, a crisis in Libya that leads to a call for a familiar word, a no-fly zone. And first the call comes from various European powers. It's quickly taken up in the U.S. by the then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, and others in the State Department. Hillary Clinton, who's supposed to be at that time the diplomat in chief, you would think she would have been calling for a diplomatic solution, but no, she was the one leading the call for a no-fly zone. The Secretary of Defense, the head of the Pentagon, who one would think would be calling for the military side, he was the one saying, no, we shouldn't be engaging. Why? Because he said, establishing a no-fly zone in Libya starts with going to war against Libya. This is Robert Gates in whatever it was, April or May of 2011, the Secretary of Defense. The Republican, he was the holdover from the Bush administration. President Obama had kept him on. And he's the one saying, it means we have to go to war with Libya. Why? Because the first thing you have to do in establishing a no-fly zone is take out the anti-aircraft system so that your patrols will be safe. Now, Libya at that time barely had an anti-aircraft system of any significance. But nonetheless, they went forward. Secretary Gates' position was defeated. Secretary Clinton's position was the one that ruled the day. The U.S. joined NATO and in a massive bombing campaign that, of course, led to the overthrow and ultimately the murder of Gaddafi. And crucially for the regional situation, as well as inside Libya, led to the throwing open of the doors of massive arms depots throughout the country. Those arms have now surfaced all throughout Central Africa, North Africa, throughout the greater Arab world. Basically, in all these conflicts, there are now Libyan arms that have been made available to pretty much anybody. Inside Libya, massive instability and massive violence, three separate governments, none of whom have any indigenous credibility. One is recognized by the UN, but none of them are seen as representing a unified country. It's a disaster. The disaster is not about the Hillary Clinton emails about Benghazi. That's not the disaster. The disaster is for the people of Libya and what's happened to their country. A lot of people at the time said that a no-fly zone is going to lead to regime change. And in the UN Security Council, the same argument was made. And people were somehow convinced that, no, 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 this is only about protecting civilians. This is not about regime change. And what a surprise. It got bad enough that the Secretary General of the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in South Africa, which voted for the resolution authorizing this so-called no-fly zone to protect civilians, later apologized, said we should have known better. We should have known it would not be limited to a no-fly zone to protect civilians, that it would become regime change, and indeed it did. Syria, the centerpiece now of the worst of all of this, also in the context of the Arab Spring, begins with a nonviolent protest movement of Syrians fed up with a very brutal dictatorial regime, looking for political reforms, an end to mass arrests, an end to torture in prison, exacerbated somewhat by conditions created by climate change. One, you know, in the Arab Spring was a regional phenomenon, but it took very different form in different countries. And in Syria, one of those forms had to do with climate change, because there had been a three-year drought that led 800,000 Syrian farmers and their families to be driven off the land. They could no longer make a living. They were forced into the cities looking for work. Until about 10 years earlier, they might have found jobs, because at that time, the Syrian economy was a kind of state socialism of a sort, with a very enormous bloated state sector that could, you know, hire pretty much anybody they wanted. About a decade before, it had turned into a kind of neoliberal economy where there was a great deal of privatization. The state sector had been vastly diminished. So people fled into the cities looking for work. There's hardly any jobs. The jobs they do find tend to go to people who know someone in power. That means they're more likely than not to be an Alawite, because that's the religious identity of the ruling family, of the Assad family, and their closest circles. Doesn't mean that only Alawites got jobs, but it just means that it exacerbated the sectarianism that had not been a big issue in Syria historically. Historically, Syria, modern Syria, had been quite secular. But suddenly, sectarianism was a big factor. So you see in Syria, with the rise of ISIS, first in Iraq, the rise of ISIS, of course, one of the consequences of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. It emerged from a U.S.-run prison, Camp Buqqa, in Iraq, where hundreds and then thousands and then tens of thousands of Iraqis were rounded up and imprisoned. And let me just ask you something about this. This happened in 2004, in the first year of the U.S. war in Iraq. And at the time that the group that became ISIS, it didn't use that name at first, it was attached to Al-Qaeda earlier, it was much less religiously focused in its earlier iterations. But at that time, it was the same time as the Abu Ghraib scandal emerged. Now let me ask the students here, how many of you have heard of Abu Ghraib? Just a couple of you. You should raise this with some of your faculty here, because that's a problem that you don't know more about Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib is something that will haunt United States foreign policy for generations. Abu Ghraib was a prison in Iraq, where Iraqis that were picked up by the U.S. occupation forces were held and interrogated, and it turns out, humiliated and tortured routinely by U.S. soldiers. This had been going on in other prisons as well. It wasn't unique to Abu Ghraib. What was unique was that a set of photographs were leaked from Abu Ghraib. And those photographs made it onto the front page of every newspaper in the country and around the world. And those photographs showed U.S. soldiers, very young U.S. soldiers, humiliating, helpless, often naked Iraqi prisoners, sometimes with a dog collar around their neck and held on a dog leash, sometimes forced to pile on top of each other in piles of naked men. It was unspeakable humiliations and unspeakable torture. Every Iraqi prisoner in a U.S. prison in those days knew that he might face the same torture. Not everyone was, but they all knew it could happen because it had happened, it had been documented, and the whole world now knew about it. It's now the symbol for Iraqis of what the U.S. occupation looked like. So in that context, that's what led to the creation of what became ISIS. ISIS becomes strong for some of the reasons I mentioned. Iraqis who are very secular in other ways, and some of them are generals, some of them have their arms, join with ISIS. They become much stronger than they would on their own. They're powerful because they don't fight alone. And suddenly they're over the border into Syria, wiping out the colonial border and saying, we are establishing this caliphate on territory across both Iraq and Syria. So the Syria war takes on this incredibly complex character. It's no longer just either a political or even an armed struggle between opposition forces and the regime. There's now both Syrian but especially regional Islamist forces, extremist forces flooding into Syria as well as into Iraq, and then global Islamist forces are coming in to join, to be part of this caliphate. So it complicates everything as we move towards the period where we see these proxy wars that I mentioned earlier.
Phyllis Benes with part one of Ending the Many Wars in Syria. She spoke in Boston on October 13, 2016. Many thanks to Dave Goodman of IBIS Radio for the fine recording. That's www.ibisradio.org. And we are at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimi non carborundum, reminding you that an injury to one is an injury to all, and hoping you'll tune in again next week when we'll have part two of Benes's talk. Y'all come back now here. Ciao.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today includes an interview from Global Research TV from the website globalresearch.ca. It's an interview with James Corbett of thecorbettreport.com and Michelle Chesedovsky, one of the founders of globalresearch.ca, both really fantastic websites. The title of their interview is Global Warfare in the New World Order. And you'll hear about the many ways to wage war on all of us and who's doing it. As you listen to this, think about how 9/11 and other false flag events serve this global agenda. So here's the interview between Michelle Chesedovsky and James Corbett.
In all major regions of the world, in various forms, in some cases it's theater wars as in Yemen, in Syria and Iraq, it's a U.S.-sponsored insurgency, the so-called Islamic State. In Latin America, it's a process of destabilization of national economies, but also militarization, the sending in of Marines to Central America. In Southeast Asia and the Far East, it's the so-called pivot to Asia. It's a situation of provocation largely directed against China. In Ukraine, on Russia's border, it's acts of provocation directed against the Russian Federation and the conquest, essentially, of new frontiers for the global economy. In Africa, it's U.S.-sponsored insurgencies, the destabilization of national economies, the battle for oil. And largely, we're dealing with very powerful corporate actors which control and overshadow the governments. If we wish to give it some kind of structure, we're talking about, of course, the oil companies, the big oil, the Anglo-American oil companies, Wall Street, of course, which is involved in financial destabilization, what President Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, which are the large defense contractors, the mercenary companies, the intelligence and security corporate apparatus, linked, of course, to the U.S. Military and to NATO. And then, of course, you have the media conglomerates, which are there serving the process of war propaganda, upholding a corporate agenda. And then you also have, and that's very important, you have the biotech conglomerates, big pharma. One dimension of this global war is the destruction and demise of the agricultural cycle. The fact that when you introduce genetically modified seeds into a region such as sub-Saharan Africa, you not only destroy agriculture, but you destroy biodiversity and you undermine the livelihood of an entire region. And that's happening in countries like India. It's happening throughout sub-Saharan Africa. And it is part of that global agenda. The global warfare is not limited to military interventions. It uses covert operations. It also is geared towards destabilizing sovereign governments through so-called colored revolutions. You know, the installation of proxy regimes, which will obey orders, and so on and so forth. It's a very complex process, and we have to connect, in a sense, all the different dimensions of this devastating process, which is destroying countries, transforming sovereign nations into territories, open space for corporations, impoverishing the world population, and that impoverishment is not the consequence of a scarcity of resources. It is the result of manipulation and destruction of economic and social structures and institutions.
Well, you paint a very vivid and concise picture of the total carnage and warfare that is encircling the globe in a number of different aspects, and you, I think, rightly identify it as part of the corporate government collusion, the fascistic collusion, which is at the heart of this empire of chaos that is reigning around the globe. I guess the obvious question then is, what is the next stage of this global warfare? Does it develop into hot warfare in the traditional sense, or will it remain on an economic covert operations level?
Well, I think that, in a sense, the military planners have all options on the table, so to speak, to quote Hillary Clinton. They are involved in covert operations and regime change, the destabilization of national economies, economic sanctions, but they are also contemplating the use of high-tech weapon systems, of course, including nuclear war. And I say nuclear war is not only targeted towards, let's say, Russia and China using the arsenal of the Cold War era, in other words, the thermonuclear weapons, but it is also directed against non-nuclear states using the so-called tactical nuclear weapons. But then there are other systems, there are other areas of intervention. We know that the U.S. Air Force has command over environmental, what is called environmental modification techniques or weather warfare. It's a controversial subject, but it's fairly well documented that the U.S. military can modify the weather and trigger environmental catastrophes. And they even use the term, and I quote, owning the weather for military use. And then you have other areas of intervention. You have biological warfare, chemical warfare. You have, of course, there's the whole area of cyber warfare, the destabilization of countries' communication systems and so on. We're in the realm of high-tech communications. And then another area, of course, of warfare is propaganda. It's turning realities upside down. It's presenting America as the protagonist of democracy and inciting people to endorse a so-called anti-terrorist agenda when it is known and documented that these terrorist organizations, including Al-Qaeda and more recently ISIS, the Islamic State, are creatures of U.S. intelligence. And so that we are now in a situation where we support a global war on terrorism, including sectors of the progressive left who say, well, we're against war, but we support the war on terrorism. It's a non sequitur. And within Western countries, there's also an internal war which is ongoing, which is the war of the governments and the corporations against their citizens, namely through the anti-terrorist legislation, where you can arrest people without any, just on suspicion because they're alleged terrorists and so on. And that trend now is evolving towards a situation of police state environment, which affects, of course, the fundamental rights of citizens. And that's happening in many countries in the West. And then with regard to the war within Western countries, you have the imposition of these deadly austerity measures. We see the situation in Greece, but it's not only in Greece. It's in countries like Spain, Italy, not to mention Iceland at a few years back. And that, in a sense, is a form of internal warfare. It's based on debt conditionalities. It's the imposition of deadly macroeconomic reforms, something which has been applied in third world countries from the beginning of the 1980s, but which is now being applied in most Western countries, leading to the demise of social programs, the destruction of employment, the creation of mass unemployment, the removal of all social safety nets, and ultimately we're evolving, and I think both at the national and global level, we're evolving from a situation of poverty to despair. People, particularly if we take countries like India, where we see a whole range of suicides in the rural areas, which are largely attributable to the crisis of agriculture and the imposition of genetically modified seeds, while people commit suicide. In Africa, we see humanitarian disasters which are beyond, so to speak, they're beyond poverty. We're not dealing with we're not dealing with global poverty, which was something which I researched in the 1990s. We're dealing with despair, with the destruction of livelihood, the destruction of family life, the deaths resulting from warfare, but also the deaths resulting from a process of engineered destruction of economic activity, where poor people are have no longer the right to be poor. They're marginalized and excluded. And simultaneously, we see, we're looking at the realm of economics, we see the emergence of this upper-end luxury goods economy, which is geared towards a small segment of the population. So there's increased polarization, social polarization taking place everywhere. You won't see, if you're traveling in Southeast Asia, you won't see the poor people. You'll see avenues of hotels and condominiums and so on. So that, in a sense, what's happening is restructuring of the fabric of national societies, where the hope of actually acceding to the status of an employee or a worker within a factory may be a dream for many people who are simply marginalized. And that is a situation even happening in countries like Spain and Greece, where, you know, up to 40% of the labor force are unemployed.
Well, in fact, we see very much that war on the poorest of the poor, even in the heart of the empire itself, with many cities trying to even make feeding the homeless a crime of sorts in the United States. So we see this being waged, and more aggressively so. I guess, then, can we see any countervailing tendencies towards this globalization of war?
Well, there are, of course, some very significant developments. If we look at the situation, let's say in Greece or in Spain, where seemingly progressive governments have emerged. But I should caution in that regard, because these seemingly progressive governments are often hijacked by corporate foundations which are funding them. It's the same thing with regard to NGOs, and they ultimately are caving in to the demands of the creditors and the large financial institutions. I think what has happened in the course of the last 20 or 30 years is that the whole fabric of particularly Western society, where you had trade unions, you had civil society organizations, which were, in fact, and you had governments, which were putting forth a progressive, a social democratic agenda. This scenario, this landscape has been totally modified. The resistance to this corporate agenda, and we're talking about global capitalism, is no longer there. It's no longer there. It's fragmented. It's co-opted. The trade union leaders go to Davos and mingle with the corporations, the corporate leaders, so that through the process of co-optation, we see a fragmentation of civil society into different areas, environmentalists on the one hand, anti-war on the other, women's rights. And ultimately, emerging from that is a mosaic of resistance rather than an organized structure which will challenge this project. And again, we're dealing with a military agenda. We're dealing with an economic agenda which is supported by the military agenda. We're dealing with a process of destabilization of livelihood, so to speak. It's the reproduction of real life which is at stake. And I think what is extremely dangerous in this situation is that those who decide, particularly with regard to the use of so-called, what we might describe as weapons of mass destruction, including nuclear weapons, they believe their own propaganda. And there's a whole current within the U.S. military, we're talking about nuclear doctrine, to the fact that nuclear weapons are, quote, harmless to the surrounding civilian population. And that refers to the tactical nuclear weapons, the mini nukes. And there are other areas of where propaganda seems to take over the people who decide. And sometimes those people mean well, but they think that by doing certain things, they're going to improve the livelihood of the world population. And so that when decision makers believe in the use of nuclear weapons as a means to bring peace to the world, we're in a very, very dangerous situation. And having consulted military documents, I can say that this is true, is that they say, well, we have to use war as a peacemaking undertaking, as a means to instill democracy. And they also say that nuclear weapons might be the avenue, okay, or certain type of nuclear weapons. And I should warn people, although this is a very complex subject, is that back in 2002, the U.S. Senate cleared the use of tactical nuclear weapons to be used in the conventional war theater, and that the whole notion that the commander-in-chief, namely the president of the United States, would actually give the green light, that has been scrapped. These tactical nuclear weapons are part of what they call the military toolbox. They can be used even by a three-star general in the region or in the war region, and they're part of the arsenal of conventional warfare. Now, all those things, all those dimensions, the economic, the social, the military dimensions, coalesce and are sustained by an extensive apparatus of media propaganda. I'm referring to the mainstream media, the corporate media, which sustains the lies and ultimately controls what people think. And this, I would say, is an inquisitorial environment. It's much more devastating than the Spanish Inquisition. The Spanish Inquisition was also based on a big lie, and it lasted for 300 or 400 years. But we are dealing with a media apparatus which turns realities upside down, presents the Western quest and military adventure as a peacemaking undertaking, which lies with regard to the casualties of war, which presents the war criminals as protagonists of human rights, and so on and so forth. And that in itself is the pinnacle of this system. It really, without the mainstream media and war propaganda, this New World Order agenda doesn't have a leg to stand on. And in other words, without these media lies, the military agenda, the economic agenda would collapse like a deck of cards. And that is why it is absolutely fundamental that within the realm of independent media and alternative media, we wage a war against the mainstream media. In other words, it's a war of ideas. It is an obligation on our part to support the truth and to use truth as a means, as a weapon, to undermine the legitimacy of this global economic and military agenda, which is destroying humanity. It is global war, it is total war, and it is destruction. And it has a logic, and it's part of global capitalism. But at this stage, it is not a struggle against socialism, but it is a struggle against national capitalism. In other words, it's the global capitalist elites, mainly Anglo-American, dominated by Wall Street and City of London, the large financial centers, against competing capitalist powers, which we might name them Russia, China. China's not a communist country. China is a capitalist country, in fact, a very advanced capitalist country. And so is Iran. And so that essentially what this war involves is world domination. It's the establishment of a global economic and political system whereby countries worldwide would be subordinated to these global corporations, where national sovereignty under national capitalism would be undermined. And the trade and investment agreements which are being negotiated behind closed doors are part of this agenda. They're part of this agenda, and in effect, they are the end game of this agenda, whereby global corporations undermine and destroy national and regional corporations, in other words, bankruptcy of the entire landscape, and impose a global economic agenda throughout the world.
And again, you've just been listening to an interview between James Corbett and Michelle Chusadovsky at Global Research TV. And again, James Corbett's website is CorbettReport.com, and Corbett is spelled C-O-R-B-E-T-T. And Michelle Chusadovsky's website is globalresearch.ca out of Canada. And Global Research was named as a fake news site. But if you've been paying attention, you know that the real fake news is the corporately controlled so-called mainstream media. Without the corporate media and some co-opted so-called alternative media supporting this global agenda, the globalists would fail. It's the truly independent media that allows us to have some inkling of what's really going on, and that's why the globalists have really begun to crack down on and attack the independent media by labeling many of them as, quote, fake news, and by limiting their internet access. Congress, which dangles on the puppet strings of the globalists, has even recently encouraged Facebook and Google and others to censor many good websites. And Facebook and Google and the others are changing their algorithms so that when you do a search for a topic, the sites like Global Research won't come up and won't be one of your choices. And Global Research and others have reported that the hits to their sites have gone way, way down because of this. I don't know about you, but when the powers that be are trying to keep me from these independent news sources, I want to connect with them all the more. So in addition to globalresearch.ca and thecorbettreport.com, here are some other sites that I would recommend if you want to learn about what's really going on. One is newsbud.org, started by Sibelle Edmonds and other great independent journalists. Sibelle has been labeled the most gagged woman in history for when she worked at the FBI after 9/11 and what she discovered there. Anyway, the site newsbud.org is a subscription site, so you need to subscribe, but you can also find some of the less current videos on YouTube. So if you go to YouTube and look for NewsBud, there's some there. And they do a great job at NewsBud of really digging into the deep state. And I just saw today that they posted a new video on the murder of John Lennon. And so again, that's newsbud.org. Another site I would recommend is WayneMadsonReport.com. Again, WayneMadsonReport.com. And as a former employee of the NSA, he has connections to the intelligence community. So his site is really worth checking out. Lots of great information there. And another good site is 21stCenturyWire.org. They do a great job covering the Middle East and Syria. And then another site is InternationalClearinghouse.com. And for 9/11, the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth site has all the scientific evidence needed to prove that the official account of how the towers came down to be totally fraudulent. And again, their website is ae911truth.org. So ae911truth.org. And it's important to understand that we've been lied to about 9/11 and that it couldn't have been pulled off by the 19 alleged Muslim hijackers, because the globalists, just mentioned by Michelle Chusadovsky, who are waging war on all of us, used 9/11 to further their global takeover agenda, blaming it on Al-Qaeda, who they actually created, armed, and funded with the help of certain allies. They also did the same with ISIS, as you heard Michelle Chusadovsky mention. Another weapon used by the globalists against us is to control the weather. Even Michio Kaku came out recently and said on CBS that the government can modify the weather and can create hurricanes, etc. Chemtrails are connected to the weather modification program, and a good website to learn more about all of this is
Geoengineering Watch. I think it's .org. So geoengineeringwatch.org. So there are some things that each of us can do to thwart the globalist corporatist takeover in our own small way. So let's start with the oil companies. We could look into getting solar panels and join organizations like PACE right here in Connecticut to learn more about sustainable energy. And when it comes to Wall Street, we could tell everyone that we know that the Federal Reserve Bank is not federal and that there's very little reserve in the bank. They're a private bank charging interest to our government for borrowed money. And we could keep our money in smaller local banks and credit unions rather than using the big corporate banks. And we could work to get a public bank here in Connecticut. And there are already people working on this. And in terms of the corporate media, you know, we can all just turn them off and watch or read them only for monitoring purposes. And you can support independent media outlets, as many of you did recently during our fund drive here at WWUH. And when it comes to genetically modified foods, we could just not eat the poison and buy organic foods or foods with the non-GMO label on them and then work to get them banned like they are in many other countries. And we could also pressure our local farmers not to use genetically modified seeds. And when it comes to big pharma, you really need to learn all you can about vaccines. Two movies that cover this well are Vaxxed, V-A-X-X-E-D, and Bought, B-O-U-G-H-T, Bought. And I believe they're both on YouTube right now. So Vaxxed and Bought. And then we all need to learn more about the corporate organization called ALEC, A-L-E-C, which is designed to get corporately friendly laws passed in each state legislature. And they've been very successful so far. And again, that's ALEC, A-L-E-C. So as I see it, the only thing that's going to stop the globalist takeover of the world, the New World Order, as they say, is collective people power. So if not you and me, then who? And if you would like to comment on the show or add your own suggestions for what we can do, I've created a new email address, which is wwuhcheryl@aol.com. And again, that's wwuhcheryl@aol.com. And that's Cheryl, C-H-E-R-Y-L. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
And you're listening to Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. Zia Mian is a physicist, activist, and co-director of Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security. His research and teaching focuses on nuclear weapons and nuclear energy policy. He's co-chair of the International Panel on Fissile Materials, a group of independent experts from 18 countries working to reduce global stockpiles of nuclear weapon usable material. He serves on the board of the Arms Control Association and received the Linus Pauling Legacy Award for his accomplishments as a scientist and a peace activist in contributing to the global effort for nuclear disarmament and for a more peaceful world. His most recent book is Unmaking the Bomb, A Fissile Material Approach to Nuclear Disarmament and Nonproliferation. Mia, thank you so much for joining us.
How are you?
Good. Although filled with trepidation at this period, perhaps more so than others in the last 10 or 15 years, there was a wonderful treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons that was adopted by an overwhelming vote at the United Nations. More than 70 years in the making, the treaty offered widely agreed principles and commitments and mechanisms for ending the nuclear weapons age, given our political landscape now. However, how meaningful is this prohibition?
It's profoundly important that we have this treaty because it does write into international law the agreed judgment of, as you mentioned, the majority of the world's countries that there is no place in the modern world for nuclear weapons or for military policies built on the possession and threat of use and use of such weapons of mass destruction. It's taken 70 years of really difficult, challenging politics by people and leaders around the world, starting from the bombing of Hiroshima, to get this to happen. So I think that we should recognize it for what it is, the beginning of the end of nuclear weapons.
Talk about the geopolitics that now witnesses nuclear disarmament diplomacy, however. At least I would characterize it as so. Perhaps you have a different position. In meltdown, and certainly no puns intended.
The way that people have thought about the need to control nuclear weapons ever since they were first made by the United States in 1945 has been that it should be the countries with nuclear weapons who should lead the process of getting rid of them. Mm-hmm. And that made sense at the beginning, since the United States had nuclear weapons and then the Soviet Union got nuclear weapons. Nobody else had nuclear weapons, and people said, look, you have to decide to get rid of these weapons. And it's worth recalling that the very first resolution ever passed by the United Nations, Resolution 1, called for a plan for the abolition of nuclear weapons. And it's taken us 70 years to get that resolution actually turned into something concrete, because for all of those 70 years, the United States and then Russia, followed by Britain and then France and then China and now the other four countries that also have nuclear weapons, Israel, India, Pakistan, and North Korea, have all said, we will do the right thing. You have to trust us. We will get to nuclear disarmament. And the world has said, we're tired of waiting for you to do the right thing. We are going to write the law that says, now you must do the right thing. And so the politics of nuclear disarmament, the shift that we have seen is that the failure of the nine countries with nuclear weapons, the most egregious failure of which is that by the United States and Russia, which have thousands upon thousands of nuclear weapons each, more than the rest of the world put together, to not take their obligation seriously and to get rid of their nuclear weapons. And people have said, enough, we're not waiting any longer, we're going to write the law that says you must do this, and now we will figure out how to try and bring that law into force and bring pressure on you to do it. But first, you need the law that says you cannot have nuclear weapons and you cannot threaten to use nuclear weapons. And that we are in the process now of putting in place.
Let's continue to focus on homegrown terrorism, if you will. How do you assess the dangers that come from the Trump administration and his coterie in conjunction with the great power tensions and rivalries, especially between the U.S., Russia, China, and so on?
Well, President Trump has a very mixed view of nuclear weapons. On one day, he's very excited about them and about the size of his nuclear button and how he wants the United States to have the biggest and most destructive nuclear arsenal in the world. On other days, he says, oh, yes, it would be great if we could get rid of them all. So this almost schizophrenic attitude about nuclear weapons is actually pretty characteristic of American presidents going back to the very beginning, to President Truman. When President Truman ordered the atomic bombing of Japan, when Hiroshima was destroyed, Truman wrote in his diary, this is the greatest thing in history. But very soon, Truman realized that nuclear weapons have profound consequences and would not contemplate their use again, for example, during the Korean War. Similarly, we think of President Kennedy and the Cuban Missile Crisis and how close we came and President Kennedy's struggle with his own advisors to prevent the use of nuclear weapons. And yet, under Kennedy and then through the 60s, the United States had a massive nuclear weapons buildup after the Cuban Missile Crisis, where you would have thought they would have realized that we are at the edge of the abyss that leads to the end of humanity. We have to stop this and roll back the nuclear age, not build more. But they built more. And so this schizophrenia about nuclear weapons both being this incredibly awesome weapon that is terrifying, and yet their idea that if we had more, we could somehow dominate, is something that's been characteristic of presidents. And even with President Obama, we had an arms control treaty with Russia to reduce the number of operational nuclear weapons that were deployed and ready to use. And yet at the same time, the Obama administration committed to a massive $1.2 trillion modernization of all of the U.S. nuclear weapons over the next 30 years with new missiles, new submarines, new bombers, new nuclear warheads to sit on all of these things. And so presidents have gone along having both been terrified of nuclear weapons and of wanting more. And so, you know, there's nothing extraordinary in how Trump sees nuclear weapons, except perhaps his kind of lack of restraint in talking about them.
One of the things that I've heard you say in other presentations and discourses is that it's an antiquated idea, for example, that we control the technology, thus we control the nuclear future. And you said the world doesn't work that way. And I just want to think about that in terms of imbuing some hope that the rest of the world, certainly those who signed the non-nuclear proliferation treaty, can really have a commanding effect on the ultimate abolition of nukes.
In the effort to try and get rid of nuclear weapons and control the technology and materials that make nuclear weapons possible, from the World War II creation of nuclear weapons until about 1968, there was basically a runaway nuclear arms race. More and more countries were starting to get them, and the technologies and the materials for making nuclear weapons were spreading. And both the United States and the Soviet Union at that time had great fear that more and more countries around the world would get nuclear weapons, and that as they got nuclear weapons, this would be a threat to the power of the United States and the Soviet Union during the Cold War to have their way in crises around the world. And so they came up with the idea of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. This was something that the United States and the Soviet Union negotiated with each other and then told the world, this is how we will control nuclear weapons. And part of that treaty, which was first signed in 1968, so it's 50 years old this year, was a promise that the countries with nuclear weapons at that time would negotiate to get rid of them. And the rest of the world said, okay, we promise not to try and make nuclear weapons, given that you've promised to negotiate to give them up. So we waited 50 years for them to keep that promise, and they didn't. There have been no negotiations among the countries with nuclear weapons to give up their nuclear weapons. And people have basically said, all right, we're tired of waiting for you. We're going to just decide what the end result of that negotiation should have been. But in the meantime, what's happened, and this is very important, is that the withdrawal of consent by the majority of the world's countries from this global nuclear agreement that we had to say, look, you know, we're tired of waiting. We don't trust you to do the right thing. We're going to figure out what the right thing is and make you do it, is the beginnings of a new way of thinking about what to do about nuclear weapons, because now there's no question of appealing to the United States and the other countries with nuclear weapons to do the right thing. Now we have countries who are taking upon themselves the obligation themselves to try and figure out how to make the United States and others give up nuclear weapons, including having now law on their side, where the next time there's a threat to use nuclear weapons, once the treaty enters into force, countries will say, actually, you know you're violating international law whenever you threaten to use nuclear weapons. You know that your policies of nuclear deterrence and building more nuclear weapons are a violation of international law, because up to now, the nuclear weapon states have been able to say, we're not doing anything wrong. There's no law that says we can't do this. And we promise that one day we'll get rid of them. Well, all of that now has to change. So I think that it's not so much a matter of the spread of technology, but the taking of responsibility by countries without nuclear weapons for the future of the world, and not wait for the nuclear-armed countries to eventually negotiate the elimination of their nuclear weapons, which is something they promised 50 years ago and just have not delivered on.
The key to long-term progress, certainly most of us, at least I, have felt must be the United States, which more than any other country has certainly set the global nuclear agenda since it made the first nuclear weapons and remains the only country, of course, ever to have used them in war. And it is the country so responsible for the existing international system. And I have so little hope for the democracy in its current evolution of the United States and playing a constructive role at all in the elimination of nuclear weaponry. So you've effectively given me hope, but that other countries and that perhaps the third world nations and so on who understand to their detriment what nuclear proliferation means can influence the process. Is that a kind of political naivete to suggest that it is anything other than the United States, which is really calling the shots again, no puns intended?
I think the days where the United States called the shots are passing. And in different issues, they have passed already, which is one reason that you have seen the appeal for so many Americans of the Trump notion of making America great again. They have this romantic, nostalgic notion sometime back in the 1950s when America was great, they thought, and they could basically tell the world what to do. But the world is a very different place now. And the idea that the United States, you know, stands on the world like this giant is long past. It actually has no connection to reality whatsoever. And the fact that almost 20 years after 9/11, the United States is still struggling in Afghanistan, 15 years it's still struggling in Iraq, it can't resolve its conflicts in Syria, it can't actually even deal with North Korea or Iran. These are not the signs of a world-dominating superpower, right, that can have its way and set the global agenda. The United States is actually extraordinarily limited in its ability to have its way. And one of the things that is increasingly important is that the resort of the Trump administration is to a much more aggressive, belligerent, militarized foreign policy to try and recover some sense of power and control over the system. But it's not working. It's just simply not working. And even if it works for a little while because they can fire, you know, dozens of cruise missiles into Syria, it doesn't resolve the fundamental underlying issue, which is that the world is not the way that the United States would like it to be, and it hasn't been that way for quite a long time. But there is actually more hope in the American system than you might imagine. One of the things that people have forgotten is that under President Obama, there was actually a profound shift in part of thinking about nuclear weapons. As I mentioned earlier, when Truman ordered the bombing of Hiroshima and the bombing was done and he wrote in his diary, this is the greatest thing in history, since 1945, no American president ever went to Hiroshima to the site of the atomic bombing to engage with the brute fact of that we destroyed an entire city, the first city ever destroyed by a nuclear weapon in the history of the world, and one of only two ever destroyed that way, and the United States destroyed both of them. No American president ever went until Obama. And he went, and he spoke, and he accepted the responsibility of what the United States did, and he hugged a survivor of the atomic bombing and said, you know, we have to try and make sure this never happens again. This marked a major shift in the moral core of what at least one element of American leadership believes to be true about nuclear weapons, that they are wrong. And so the fact that Obama represented a new generation of American politicians, people who, you know, grew up at the end of the Cold War and not in the early years of the Cold War, who have no romantic notions of a white male Christian America in the 1950s ruling the world. These are signs of progress. The next generation of young Americans, the millennials and people of similar age, overwhelmingly don't support nuclear weapons. All the polling shows that it is older people, not younger people, who think nuclear weapons are a good idea. The future is on our side as young Americans start to get some distance from the idea of America as a superpower with some entitlement to shape the world. So I think that with the rest of the world and the next generation of young Americans, and more women are opposed to nuclear weapons than men are opposed to nuclear weapons. Minorities are more opposed to nuclear weapons than white men are opposed to nuclear weapons. So there is a political coalition to be built in the United States among progressives, among women, minorities, young people, people who care about the environment, and the rest of the world, which can actually take on the American military-industrial complex and the old ideas about America and power and force and how to run the world that can actually change things. So there is lots of reasons for hope.
How do you assess, I know that you were actually just in Seoul, your concerns and your assessment about the upcoming talks with North Korea?
Leaders of North Korea and South Korea are meeting, and this is an enormously important meeting. Only the third meeting between the leaders of those two countries since the Korean War, you know, is this continuing effort by progressive-minded politicians in South Korea to try and build a peace process with the North. And with luck, and all the signs are positive so far, that it will be a successful summit with the possibilities of them agreeing more than just a statement of good intent, but laying the basis for a treaty that will actually finally resolve and end the Korean War, which, as you and your listeners may know, did not actually end with a peace treaty in 1953, but only with a ceasefire, an armistice. So we have a step to take to actually end that old conflict and begin to deal with the existence of two separate countries, a North Korea and a South Korea, and figure out how they can manage their relations going forward in a peaceful way. The real wild card will be the summit between Donald Trump and the leader of North Korea. This will be the first ever meeting between the leaders of the United States and North Korea. And the fact that Trump said yes to such a meeting is actually an important step. I'm not sure he understood that what he was doing when Trump said yes. Normally, American leaders have argued that the summit should be at the end of the diplomatic process to seal the deal, whereas Trump likes to do these things at the beginning so he can take credit for everything. But we'll see how that goes. It's still too early to tell, and everybody's waiting to see how the deal with North Korea and South Korea actually goes and what might be in it. But I think we should all hope that these processes go well, because talking and trying to make agreements between countries is a much better way of managing their relations than threatening war. And you have to remember that Trump and the leader of North Korea only a few months ago were boasting to each other about the size of their nuclear buttons and how they were going to rain fire and fury on each other and so on. And so to get from that to an agreement to have a summit and to actually talk like civilized human beings, or at least to try to begin the process of having diplomacy, is something that we should support and welcome and encourage and press both sides to the extent that we can to do this in good faith. And even if you can't get everything you want in the first round of talks, to at least keep talking and give diplomacy and peace a chance.
And how do you look at the deal with Iran?
As a candidate, Trump was vehemently opposed to the deal, as he was, you know, opposed to everything that President Obama had done, be it healthcare, be it climate change. You know, he's so determinedly anti-Obama. But on the Iran deal, not only is it the case that the United Nations Security Council unanimously supported the Iran deal at the behest of the United States, but that the European allies of the United States all support the Iran deal. And most people in the United States support the deal for the simple reason that it does restrain Iranian nuclear capability for at least the next decade, and in some cases, on some issues, far beyond that. And it lays the basis for rebuilding the United States relationship with Iran. And, you know, Trump can huff and puff all he wants, but, you know, those are the brute facts of the matter. But, you know, Trump has a blindness to consequence, as we've seen in many of his policies. And it may well be that just by sheer, you know, determination that, you know, he has to have his own way no matter what the consequences, and reimpose the sanctions on Iran. And then we'll have to wait and see what the government of Iran will do and what other countries will do and to what extent they will fall in behind the United States and to what extent they will try and keep some kind of possibility of the Iran deal and of trade and diplomacy with Iran in operation. It's very, very fraught. It's a very difficult situation that Trump has created. And, you know, John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and others in the Trump administration are all very hardline in their positions with regard to Iran. So in that regard, you know, things don't look too hopeful. But, you know, the rest of the world does have a voice in this. And the president of France has been pressing him. The chancellor of Germany is sure she will make the same case to Trump that, you know, the Iran deal is actually in everybody's best interest. But if people do want to avoid another crisis in the Middle East, now is the time for them to pick up the phone and start calling their members of Congress and say, look, we don't want another war in the Middle East. Don't want more and more crises in the world. And I think that's the way that, you know, people have to try and take control of their government.
And within this and the escalation of conventional warfare, for example, the airstrikes on Syria, which are surely in defiance of international law, they most definitely increase the likelihood of the terrible conflict spilling over into wider Middle East and potentially beyond that. How do you look at that and the conventional war within the question of these geopolitical conflicts that can become a trigger to nuclear interventions?
Well, this is a really good question, Mimi, and I think people need to keep their eye on this. You have to remember that many of the ideas that Trump has and that his supporters like Bolton and Pompeo and others have about nuclear weapons and war and the Middle East and so on, they are in many ways a recycle of the ideas that got us into this mess in the first place during the Bush administration. And this includes Iran and North Korea. So Trump, for example, supports the use, the development by the United States of new kinds of nuclear weapons that would be more usable. This is exactly the idea that the Bush administration had when it came into power in 2000, that we need new nuclear weapons which are smaller and would be more usable and that would, you know, scare more people that the United States is serious. It was also the Bush administration that responded to a summit, the first summit between North Korea and South Korea was back in 2000, And what did the Bush administration do? They called the North Koreans the axis of evil, and then they invaded Iraq and threatened to invade Iran. And the mess that is in the Middle East was a result of Bush, Cheney, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, all those people that many of your listeners will remember. And we're still struggling to deal with the consequences of what their policies unleashed in the Middle East. The war in Iraq that has dragged on and on and on and taken so many lives and destroyed entire societies and left a swath of destruction, which now runs all the way to Syria. And so I think that you have to remember that this endless war that the United States unleashed in the Middle East under the Bush administration is something that is, you know, crushing the lives of entire countries. And the United States is directly responsible for the suffering of all those people, including, you know, the 500,000 people that have died so far in the conflict in Syria. So I think that worrying about future wars and the threat of nuclear weapons is profoundly important. But the fact of the matter is that there are real wars with real people dying every day. And, you know, people need to own their responsibility and try and, you know, make sure that the United States government does all that it can to end these wars as quickly as possible and accept its responsibility for having brought such suffering to those countries and those people.
I want to thank you for all of the work that you've done and for spending some time with us, Dr. Zia Mian. I want to thank you again for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Mimi.
And Zia Mian is a physicist, activist, and co-director of Princeton University's Program on Science and Global Security, and gave us some of his thoughts on moving towards nuclear abolition.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The love that dare not speak its name was a line of poetry written by Lord Alfred Douglas that was used in the court case against Oscar Wilde.
It's not really accurate to apply today's meaning of the word gay to people who lived in times when the understanding of homosexuality was so different.
I wonder where you are, lovable lady.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A Belfast baker's cake case mirrors a top U.S. court controversy, Trump's new faith initiative preys on queer rights, and Oscar and Bozy meet Alexander and Dusty. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Seth Eric Cutler.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending May 5th, 2018. The Supreme Court of the United Kingdom, sitting in Northern Ireland this week, heard arguments in a case that's similar to one now being considered by the U.S. Supreme Court. Both involve appeals of lower court rulings rejecting a bakery owner's religious liberty to refuse to make a cake with a pro-queer message on it. In the UK case that began in 2014, evangelical Christian owners Daniel and Amy MacArthur of Belfast's Asher's Bakery refused to put icing on a cake ordered by gay activist Garth Lee that said, "Support gay marriage." Their lawyer, David Schofield, told the High Court that the McCarthys were confronted with choosing between operating their businesses or living and acting in accordance with their religious beliefs, and we say that cannot be the law. Lee's attorney countered that no abusive intent was involved in placing the order. Lady Hale, the president of the Supreme Court, told the BBC that a decision would not be announced anytime soon. These cases are by definition complex and difficult. A ruling is expected later this year or in early 2019. The U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments in December 2017 in a case involving a Colorado baker who cited his religious liberty rights in refusing to make a wedding cake once he knew his customers were a gay male couple. America's High Court is expected to issue its ruling sometime next month.
U.S. President Donald Trump used the National Day of Prayer on May 3rd to sign an executive order that critics charge is a license to discriminate against LGBTQ people based on religious belief. According to a White House press release, the establishment of a White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative aims to ensure that the faith-based and community organizations that form the bedrock of our society have strong advocates in the White House and throughout the federal government. It allows the administration to weigh in on policies involving faith-based organizations and also requires that the administration be notified of any failures to comply with religious liberty protections under law. A Trump spokesperson told The Washington Post that the executive order is less concerned about where the church-state barriers are and is focused more on effective programs without all of these arbitrary concerns as to what is appropriate.
Queer advocacy groups say they'll challenge any implementation of the executive order in court. "Freedom of religion is absolutely a core value of our nation," a Lambda legal tweet said. "What we're concerned about is the weaponization of that right. Weaponization that allows for and encourages discrimination and harm," it said. "Religious freedom is not freedom to discriminate." One wonders if these continuing attempts by the Trump administration to erode LGBTQ rights in the name of religious liberty are not the specific handiwork of Vice President Mike Pence, a self-avowed Christian, conservative, Republican in that order.
Lawmakers in the U.S. states of Kansas and Oklahoma each approved bills within one day of each other this week to allow adoption or fostering agencies to reject same-gender couples based on the agency management's sincerely held religious beliefs. The Republican-dominated Kansas legislature sent the bill to Republican Governor Jeff Collier, who has already said he'll sign it. The Oklahoma bill even allows publicly funded agencies to discriminate against queer couples. It's unclear as we record this newscast if GOP Governor Mary Fallon will sign her state's bill into law. Opponents argued that the legislation in each state is so sweeping that it could allow adoption or fostering agencies to reject applications from interracial heterosexual couples or from couples who don't adhere to specific religious faith.
But the Republican-controlled New Hampshire state legislature passed a bill this week to protect transgender people from discrimination. Republican Governor Chris Sununu is expected to sign it into law. The bill updates the state's anti-discrimination laws covering employment, housing, and public accommodations to specifically protect transgender people. With progress at the federal level under the Trump administration virtually impossible, activists have been advancing progressive legislation at the state level. Lawmakers in Maryland and Hawaii recently banned so-called conversion therapy for minors. In late April, Massachusetts joined California to offer an LGBTQ-inclusive curriculum in public schools. Illinois may soon follow.
In other news, a letter from nearly half of the U.S. Senate was delivered to Defense Secretary James Mattis this week, criticizing the administration's approach to military service by qualified transgender enlistees and its disregard for established research certifying the worthiness of their service. It equated Trump's approach to trans service to the now-defunct Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy that at one time banned openly lesbi-gay service members. The letter specifically slammed a memo sent by Mattis to the president in February, in which the defense secretary claimed that opening service to out-trans people posed substantial risks and an unreasonable burden on the military. New York Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, a Democrat, recruited 49 senators to sign on to the letter, one Republican, Alaska's Lisa Murkowski, and every Democrat except West Virginia's Joe Manchin. Just as our mistaken policy regarding lesbian, gay, and bisexual service members harmed readiness and ultimately was repealed, the implementation of your recommendations will also harm our nation's military, the letter charged. The military should establish a policy which includes all Americans who are willing to serve and a policy that reasonably protects the military's interest as an employer in providing necessary medical care for those willing to serve our country.
Meanwhile, the Think Progress website reported this week that the Trump administration intended to stick with the president's plan to ban transgender troops, regardless of what a panel of experts recommended. The site's review of documents released through the discovery process in lawsuits against the ban finds a massive disconnect between what was discussed in the meetings of the panel and what was ultimately recommended, the site charges, reinforcing concerns that the process was rigged from the beginning in favor of a ban. Several federal courts have temporarily stopped the ban from being implemented while its constitutionality is being challenged.
Updating two stories we've been following, Hong Kong's highest court this week rejected efforts by some of the world's biggest financial institutions and law firms, along with Amnesty International, to intervene on behalf of a lesbian plaintiff seeking a spousal visa for her British wife. The couple married in England in 2011. The government is appealing a lower court ruling that said the British spouse was entitled to the visa. The rejection by the Court of Final Appeal to the support being offered by the financial and legal institutions is seen as a significant blow to the couple's case. A spokesperson for the coalition of banks and law firms told the South China Morning Post that Hong Kong faces strong competition from other international financial cities in the region and globally, and the current immigration policy risks putting Hong Kong behind other jurisdictions.
But Chile's recently inaugurated president, Sebastián Piñera, who is said to be no fan of equality, has conceded through a spokesperson that his country must comply with the January ruling of the Inter-American Court of Human Rights that requires all countries in the region without marriage equality to open the institution to gay and lesbian couples. Cecilia Perez confirmed this week in a meeting with the country's leading queer advocacy group, the Movement for Homosexual Integration and Liberation, that the Piñera administration will follow the conclusions issued last month by the Comptroller General, who said that compliance was mandatory.
And finally, the political buttons on the vest of the U.S. Teacher of the Year spoke volumes, even though the honoree gave no acceptance speech. In a ceremony on May 2nd, President Donald Trump presented the Crystal Apple Trophy to Mandy Manning, who teaches English to newly arrived immigrant and refugee children at Joel E. Ferris High School in Spokane, Washington. Trump either didn't see or didn't want to see the numerous campaign buttons she was wearing and said nothing about them. One was in support of the Peace Corps, which Trump has threatened to shut down, and the National Endowment for the Arts, another Trump target. She also prominently displayed another button in support of the Women's March that took place soon after Trump's inauguration, and one calling for trans equality now. Manning also handed the president a stack of letters written by her teenage refugee pupils detailing their experiences of arriving in the U.S. and what it meant to them. Given Trump's well-known aversion to reading, however, it's doubtful that they'll ever see the light of day in the Oval Office.
That's NewsWrap, Global Queer News with Attitude, for the week ending May 5th, 2018. Written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at the newly renovated thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Seth Eric Cutler.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
She claims she learned her makeup techniques from female impersonators.
You've got until the end of the show to guess who that was about. But first, the Rainbow Minute guys share a letter to Bozy, and Janet Mason sees Oscar's ghost.
Oscar Wilde's letter to Bozy, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Lost for 50 years, some letters and manuscripts by Oscar Wilde were rediscovered in 2008. Now housed at the Morgan Library in New York, they detail the life and writings of Wilde during the 1890s while living in England. Among the volume is the earliest surviving letter from Wilde to his beloved Lord Alfred Douglas, whom he called Bozy. Written around 1892 on stationery of the Albemarle Club, the letter speaks of their relationship. Wilde wrote, "Dearest Bozy, I am so glad you are better. Oxford is quite uncomfortable in winter. I go to Paris next, or in the next 10 days or so. I should awfully like to go away with you somewhere where it is hot. I am terribly busy in town. Of the poem I will write tomorrow, Oscar." The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mike Rutz.
This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out. History is a messy business. After all, it does involve human beings. I have not thought of this until now, specifically when I read the 2017 biography titled Oscar's Ghost, The Battle for Oscar Wilde's Legacy by Laura Lee, published by Emberley Publishing in England. The book covers some new territory. It portrays a struggle for literary control over Wilde's estate. But the first 150 pages or so were about the events of Wilde's life. Events that led up to the struggle over his writing by the two men in his life. This was fortunate for me because, in full disclosure, I had not read any of the previous biographies about Wilde. Here is a short version. Wilde was born in 1854 in Dublin, Ireland, went to college in England, married a woman as custom dictated, became a well-known writer, discovered he was gay, fell hopelessly in love with a younger man named Lord Alfred Douglas, and went to jail for that love in 1895. He was then released from jail in 1897, and in 1900 died penniless. It was interesting to read that the well-known line, "The love that dare not speak its name," was a line of poetry written by Lord Alfred Douglas that was used in the court case against Oscar Wilde. It was as equally fascinating to read that when Oscar spoke of his devotion to Lord Alfred Douglas, nicknamed Bozy, in the courtroom, that the attendees of the trial applauded. This is proof that people, at least some of them, are always more enlightened than the laws that govern them. Oscar was found guilty and went to jail. In prison, he wrote that what is arguably his best work, titled De Profundis, Latin for From the Depths, a letter to Lord Alfred Douglas. We have this work because Oscar handed it to his good friend and literary executor, Robert Ross, who was also his occasional lover. The long essay did not portray Lord Alfred Douglas in a good light. After all, Douglas was the reason that Oscar had gone to jail and lost everything. Nevertheless, after Oscar's release from jail, the two men reunited and for a short time lived in Naples. After Oscar died an untimely death from a rare disease, Lord Alfred Douglas learned of the existence of De Profundis and that it was written as a letter to him. Because of this, he considered it his personal property and went into a litigious rage. The two men knew of Oscar's involvement with each of them, and for a while they were good friends. The enmity that grew between them after Oscar's death was unfortunate. But we do have Robert Ross to thank for establishing Oscar Wilde's legacy. In the conclusion, the author notes how fast things have changed. In March 2014, same-sex marriage became legal in the UK. A little more than a year later, it became the law of Oscar Wilde's native land. In January 2017, Wilde was posthumously pardoned, along with 50,000 other gay men who had been convicted under a law that no longer exists. It can only be hoped that we are finally entering an era when men who love men can, indeed, be dead to all sense of shame. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
Yeah, we go way, 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 way back. We love, love, love like that.
Way, 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 way back.
Outcasting Overtime's Wayback Machine takes a young ally on a trip to find the gay beginning for a happy ending.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Sam, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Outcaster Lucas talks about the transition in society from viewing homosexuality as a disease to an identity.
While you scroll through Facebook, you may stumble upon an article claiming that George Washington or Alexander the Great was gay. While we don't have knowledge to say whether these claims are true or not, we can say that at the times that these individuals were alive, nobody would truly identify as gay, even if they did have sexual relations with other people of the same sex. Being gay, as it is today, has grown to be understood as an identity relatively recently. Historically, LGBTQ people have hidden what were considered contrary sexual feelings. But being able to express these emotions and urges differs greatly from being able to identify as gay or LGBTQ. We probably can't say that these people were gay in today's definition of the word, but they may have had such sexual feelings. These new labels may form a better picture of what it means to be homosexual, but also changes the meaning of heterosexual. Originally, the definitions of homosexuality and even heterosexuality were obscure medical terms that described what were considered abnormal sex drives. In 1909, homosexuality was defined as a morbid sexual passion for one of the same sex. During the years leading up to 1973, there was a movement in the mental health community to depathologize homosexuality, and in 1987, all aspects of homosexuality were removed from the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or DSM, a manual that is used to identify mental illnesses. Today, it is archaic to call homosexuality a mental illness, a tic or a phase, as it was considered in the first official medical document on this topic, titled Contrary Sexual Feeling. However, in the past, having sexual feelings was simply a phase in a feeling, not a decisive factor in who someone was. Being gay is now better understood as an identity, a way of being, rather than a problem or a short-term urge. Historically, strict gender roles were also defined by the creation of duties and jobs specific to each gender. This was based on the importance of procreation and further strengthened the idea of homosexuality as a problem, not only as people being strange, but as endangering the future of a community, seeing that gay people couldn't procreate with each other. This started to change in the post-World War II era, when Alfred Kinsey, a now-famous sexual behaviorist, came along and, based on extensive primary research, introduced the idea of sexuality as a continuum. This challenged the idea of sexuality as a binary. Until then, you were either straight or gay. Kinsey introduced a scale to describe people's sexual tendencies, with 0 being completely straight and 6 being completely homosexual, and 1 through 5 being at various points in between. This understanding of sexuality fell in line more with a more sophisticated idea of human identity. The continuum also established the idea that sexuality was more of an emotional aspect of a person. After many years of fighting, increasing liberal and modern thought resulted in homosexuality being removed from the DSM. These new definitions allow people to reconsider sexual desires and experiences as legitimate when they may not have been open-minded earlier. They can potentially understand their desires as a characteristic of their identity and not as a problem to be solved. As a straight guy living in the 21st century, I understand that in the future, if I do have feelings for another guy, I can consider it as a healthy and legitimate emotional connection and not as a medical problem or phase. The word gay, as a more common, less medical term for homosexual, became established in the 1960s. People like George Washington may have had homosexual tendencies, and if they lived today, they might have been considered gay and might have considered themselves to be gay. But it's not really accurate to apply today's meaning of the word gay to people who lived in times when the understanding of homosexuality was so different.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting. Watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to the show. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Her biggest hits in the 1960s didn't address what her cover did of a woman's music anthem from the 1970s by lesbian feminist singer-songwriter Margie Adam, as you'll hear now in another Rainbow Minute.
Dusty Springfield's Beautiful Soul, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. A camp icon of glamorous excess, with her towering beehive hairdo and heavy black mascara, Dusty Springfield is acclaimed as one of the greatest popular music voices ever. Also an icon to gay and lesbian culture, she claims she learned her makeup techniques from female impersonators. On an album shelved for years was a track called Beautiful Soul, in which Springfield sang of love for a woman. It was the first and only time the self-professed bisexual dared to do so. Today, the song is often heard at lesbian weddings and commitment ceremonies worldwide. Just before her death, in 1999, Springfield was awarded the Order of the British Empire by Queen Elizabeth II. Her song, Beautiful Soul, was released sometime after her death. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Herschel Stratego.
Settling in.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Francis O'Brien and Seth Eric Cutler, with thanks to Brian DeShazer, from Outcasters, Sam and Lucas, produced by Mark Salfos, Mike Rutz and Herschel Spertigio, produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns, and from Janet Mason. Olivia Holt and Dusty Springfield performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. 30th anniversary greetings are still gratefully being accepted at the all-new thiswayout.org. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, iTunes, and Google Plus. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Tasman FM, Nubina, Tasmania, BCFM, Bristol, England, WPSU, University Park, Pennsylvania, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
Thank you. You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Karl Marx was born in Prussia 200 years ago on May 5, 1818. Yet arguably, the dynamically destructive capitalism he analyzed in works such as Capital describes our world even more acutely than the 19th century one that he inhabited. A thinker of tremendous brilliance, Marx's legacy is a complicated one, owing to the 20th century societies established in his name. To talk about some of Marx's central ideas and sort out Marx's vision from those of his successors, I'm joined by David McNally. He's professor of political science at York University in Toronto, a longtime activist, and the author of many books, including Monsters of the Market and Global Slump, which, in the interest of full disclosure, I should say I edited and is published by PM Press, which I'm connected to. David, why should we care about Marx? He died 135 years ago, and on the right and in the center, he's seen as a failed prophet of a disastrous social system, as witnessed by the Soviet Union. On parts of the left, he's seen as irrelevant in times where struggles over race and gender may seem more important than struggles over class. So why should we still return to the ideas of Marx?
I would start by saying that the world we live in today more resembles the world that Marx saw coming into being when he was writing his great texts in political economy than at any other time in history. And so really, the first question with respect to Marx's relevance is, do we live in a global capitalism? And if the answer to that is yes, then the next question becomes, does that global capitalism display some of the key characteristics that Marx said were intrinsic to the system? And by that, I mean increased and heightened forms of exploitation of labor, including casualization, precarious work, growing insecurity for huge numbers of people, intense social inequality, which becomes more exaggerated, particularly in our so-called neoliberal age? And is the system, as Marx suggested, globalizing? After all, in Marx's day, capitalism was essentially in one corner of the European continent. And yet I think most commentators would agree that today it is a genuinely world or global system. And so the first part of the question of Marx's relevance is really, does our world today consist of a capitalist society with the dynamics and the tensions that he described? And my submission would be that, in fact, it does so more than ever before. And this gives Marx's work an immense social and historical explanatory power and social and political relevance. Now, the other side of the question that you raised is really about whether Marx's concerns with class have been historically transcended by new identities and new movements with respect to gender or race, sexuality, ability, and so on. And I would come at that in two ways. The first would be to say that there is no doubt that Marx did not attend to many of these phenomena to the degree to which many current social critics and social justice activists would like to do. In other words, that if Marx remains relevant, it also is the case that there's a lot of work to do to renovate and update his analyses in ways that speak to a whole range of concerns around identity and oppression that he either didn't discuss or in some cases discussed in a way that we would find too cursory, too superficial. And so that's the first aspect that I think is important here. But the other side of this question with respect to class and identity and so on is really to ask, even if these social oppressions around gender, sexuality, race, and ability, for instance, are of more pressing concern to many of us than they were in Marx's day, can we adequately understand them and can we adequately address them without an analysis of capitalist class relations, the social inequalities that they produce, and so on? And again, I think one of the really interesting things about so many developments in these areas in recent years, particularly, I would say, since the global financial crisis of 2009 and the rise of movements like Occupy, all of the movements that have been highlighting social inequality, is that growing numbers of anti-racists, feminists, queer activists, environmental activists, and the like have actually been trying to turn to Marx to integrate a much richer anti-capitalism into their understanding of the world. And so it seems to me that Marx remains highly relevant to people who in the first instance enter political criticism and action around more identity-based oppressions than, say, typical or traditional working class politics. And I would add as a sort of final note to that, one of the things, of course, we're seeing increasingly as well today is that it is very often the gendered and racialized sections of the working class who are most significantly moving into social protest and social opposition, whether we're talking about the wave of teacher strikes that we've seen in parts of the U.S. or fast food worker organizing across North America and so on. So to say that Marx has a continued relevance is not to say he has all the answers for every question we might ask 135 years later. It is more to say he is indispensable still to understanding how we go about addressing those issues.
What was Marx's background and his political evolution?
Marx's background is quite interesting, and I'll start here with an insight from the late Hal Draper, who wrote a very extensive four-volume work on the development of Marx's political thinking and practice. And he makes the comment in one of his volumes that Marx was the first socialist who came to socialism through the struggle for democracy. And I highlight that quote by Hal Draper because what he was trying to emphasize is that Marx was not the first socialist. The combination of all of the social transformations in Europe that we associate with the rise of capitalism, the agrarian and industrial revolutions, the French revolutions and the struggles for liberal democracy and so on, that many earlier thinkers had started to move through those social transformations towards the idea of a new kind of social order, which they sometimes called socialism. And socialism usually for them meant that a system that addressed and tried to resolve the social problem. And the social problem was poverty. Now, interestingly, as Draper points out, because Marx came to this through the struggle for democracy, he began as a radical Democrat, as a young journalist in the early 1840s in Germany. He was the editor of the most radical democratic newspaper of the era in 1842 and 1843. And it was because he came to the realization that the existing structure of social and property relations was a block on democracy that he then moved into the camp of socialism. And that's highly significant because what it means is that from the start, Marx's thinking about socialism is pitched in terms of radical democracy. And radical democracy beginning, of course, for the young Marx with the overcoming of alienated labor in the workplace becomes really the index, the measure of any kind of socialist progress. So I think that's hugely important. In addition, Marx came out of a secularized Enlightenment Jewish household. In other words, although some of his grandfathers, excuse me, both of his grandfathers had been rabbis, his own father was highly secular. He had been deeply influenced by Enlightenment ideas about rationality and social progress. He had moved outside of really religious reference points. And so what Marx inherits there is a radical tradition inflected by what we sometimes call the radical Enlightenment, not its more liberal versions, but those elements of the Enlightenment which really believed that we had entered the age of popular sovereignty, of control of society by the people capable of reasoning about their own affairs. And so that also inflects and informs the ways in which Marx thinks about the struggle for socialism. And in particular, to what we've come to describe as the principle of self-emancipation. Consistent with that democratic principle that I was describing, Marx consistently, from 1843 until the end of his life in 1885, Marx consistently argued that socialism can only be brought about by the self-emancipation of the working class, or as he put it literally, only the working class can emancipate itself. And that, it seems to me, is a crucial part of the Marxian inheritance today. And interestingly, going back to the point about Marx's relevance, speaks, I think, very powerfully to contemporary concerns about creating more radical forms of social organization. And here I'm thinking of the assembly style decision making that the Occupy movement tried to develop. The same thing was happening, of course, in the 2011 revolution in Egypt, where hundreds of thousands of people seized Tahrir Square in Cairo and created new assembly-style structures of mass decision-making, or the movement of the squares at roughly the same time in parts of Europe, particularly in Spain. In all of these social movements, and I would say, by the way, also in some of the recent teacher rebellions, where teachers have been calling mass assemblies to make decisions, we see this push towards a new kind of radical democracy from below that was really in keeping with Marx's commitments. The final element that I would add, and it's an often misunderstood one, is that Marx was deeply influenced by the philosophy of Hegel, George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel, the philosophy which had dominated and then been marginalized the German situation in the academy during his lifetime, Marx's lifetime as a student. And fundamentally what he got from that was the idea that we need to understand the world dynamically. Social reality is a process, not a thing. And as a result, if capitalism today does not look identical to the Victorian capitalism of 1860 that Marx saw in front of him when he was writing his great work, Capital, in London, that shouldn't surprise us, because Marx has tried to get us to see the system as one that's constantly transforming itself around the same basic social logic, the same structural principles. Similarly, he insisted that we try to see all social situations as relational, as involving relations between social groups, and not to imagine, as he put it, that capital is a thing. Capital is a social relationship. And so we're not just struggling against a power external to ourselves, we are struggling to change the social relationships in which we find ourselves. And that notion of transforming social relationships becomes, I think, crucial to his thinking. So those are the elements that I would really highlight: the democratic inheritance, the principle of self-emancipation and the way that comes out of a certain radical Enlightenment tradition, and this insistence on understanding reality historically and dynamically and in terms of the social relations among people.
I'm speaking with activist and professor of political science at York University in Toronto, David McNally, about the legacy of Karl Marx. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. David, what was the interplay between the development of Marx's ideas over the course of his life and the social struggles that he saw around him and that he was engaged with, the most momentous earlier on in his life being the revolutions of 1848?
Yes, and picking up from one of our earlier points here, Sasha, it's really significant to highlight that as soon as Marx decided that he was, in fact, a person on the socialist left, he sought out working class clubs, working men's organizations. He was forced into exile, and so while he had some contact in Germany before he left, it was really in Paris in 1844 that he began to interact on a regular basis with left-wing working-class organizations of French workers and of German émigrés. And he always spoke throughout the rest of his life extremely reflectively and powerfully about the impact that those meetings, those discussions had on him. And he saw himself as being educated by workers in struggle. And that, of course, goes back both to the commitment to self-emancipation. As Marx really would say, one of the lines, of course, we have from the working class ballad, The Internationale, "We want no condescending saviors." Marx was very committed to that idea. He was no savior. He did not condescend to the working class. He sought to work alongside and within its movements. And that, of course, meant that when revolutions did break out, as you say, in 1848 in both France and Germany, that immediately he and his co-thinkers, they had been organized in two different groups, one called the League of the Just and the other called the Communist League, these two organizations. Then Marx worked with them as best he could to be part of those revolutions, to contribute particularly by writing pamphlets and documents that could be of service in those struggles. And for Marx, the class struggles of workers around him were the real laboratory of social revolution. And his job was not to prescribe, to dictate, or to legislate, but in fact to illuminate, to, as he puts it at one point, to clarify the struggles of the age. And that's what he sought to do with his involvement here. And that's why we also need to be careful sometimes taking a single text by Marx and ascribing to it a timeless status. Marx's texts are contextual. And as the world changed, as the working class struggle changed, so did his own thinking. And so let me offer you a few examples of how he learned from actual struggles in ways that changed his own thinking. First, there is the question of the state itself. In the Communist Manifesto in 1848, he and his lifelong friend Engels, Frederick Engels, had written that the working class needs to conquer the state. Then when the workers of Paris in 1871 rose up and established the Commune of Paris, the Paris Commune, Marx recognized that they weren't conquering the state, they were displacing it. They were substituting for the old state a new commune structure with direct delegates, grassroots organization, democracy in the communities and the workplace. And Marx and Engels, immediately after that event, wrote a new preface to the Communist Manifesto where they said, when we first wrote this, we said that the workers need to conquer the state. The workers of Paris have corrected us. They have shown that what workers need to do is to smash or dismantle the existing state and replace it with a commune. And so there's a beautiful example of not trying to prescribe the direction of history, but of learning from the struggles of workers. I'll offer one or two other examples. Marx spent a lot of time, of course, in Britain. And in the 1840s, when he arrived there, the key working class movement was called the Chartists, and had that name due to its 10-point charter, which was a charter of working class rights, which included the right to vote. But in key leadership positions in the Chartist movement, the most important working class movement of the era in Britain, were Irish immigrants. And Marx was drawn to the radicalism of these Irish working class activists in England. And in particular, so was one of his daughters, Jenny, who became incredibly active in building solidarity with Irish struggles, and then as did his younger daughter, Eleanor. And in all kinds of conversations, Marx got won over in discussions with Chartists and with his own daughters to the idea that rather than having the view that the solution to the colonial oppression of Ireland was for the English workers to overthrow capitalism and essentially free the Irish, Marx was persuaded that no, the Irish struggle on its own can be a great lever of social upheaval throughout Great Britain. And so he moved to a position in the 1860s of advocating Irish independence, of supporting the anti-colonial struggle as itself of enormous merit in the social struggles of the day. And then the third example I'll give actually comes from America, where Marx was, as a growing number of analysts are recognizing today, hugely interested in the issue of slavery in the U.S. South, which, by the way, he considered a form of capitalist slavery, contrary to some later so-called Marxists, Marx said absolutely this is a form of capitalist slavery. It is unlike any of the slavery we have seen before. And he was hugely interested in the movements of abolitionists in the U.S. He followed the uprising at Harper's Ferry led by John Brown, for instance. He talked about it as having world historic significance. And he said the same thing during the U.S. Civil War. Marx was among the first who was essentially calling for an Emancipation Proclamation from the beginning and for arming slaves who would cross over to Union lines. And during this period, you see slavery and the question of anti-black racism in the United States entering into Marx's theoretical reflections in ways that really have not been fully appreciated. And I think finally today, there are some scholars, I would mention Kevin Anderson in his book, Marx at the Margins, who have started to draw attention to some of the significance of this line of thinking for Marx. But it was social struggles in the United States. It was his friends in the First International in the United States, particularly emigrant German socialist radicals in the U.S., who were drawing Marx into these conversations and changing his thinking. And so I highlight those because they are examples of not trying to prescribe in advance the course of history, but recognizing that Marx's commitment was, as I said, to clarifying the struggles of the age, and that requires learning.
Marx was incredibly prolific, but his masterwork is The Incompleted Capital. Why is it such an important and enduring work in your estimation? Volume 1 was published in 1867.
Yes, that's right. And you're absolutely right that if Marx's intellectual legacy rests on one work, it is Capital Volume 1. It's the only work of his great critique of political economy. It's the only volume that he saw to completion during his lifetime. And he simply left manuscripts afterwards. But Volume 1, it seems to me, is an unsurpassed account of how capitalism works. And it is that because Marx allows us to understand the truly mysterious nature of capitalism. It's incredible to sit and read that text today and to realize that in the 1860s, Marx was saying to us, do you realize that a world in which, in order to feed yourself, you must first go into some market institution like a store and hand over something called money in order to subsist and to feed yourself and the members of your household? Do you realize how odd it is that in order to house yourself, you need a contract and payments that go through a housing and rental market? Do you understand that for most of human life, most of human social existence, this is not how people stayed alive? And this is mysterious. There is something to be explained here. It is not natural. This is not how it has been across all the eons of human existence. And so we need to understand, as he says, the riddle of the commodity. How is it that the overwhelming bulk of the things that we need for social existence, food, shelter, clothing, recreational activities, books, music, computers, and so on, all of those are commodities that must be purchased through markets. And in setting out that way, Marx posed a problem that no one in the history of political economy up until that time and no one in mainstream economic thinking ever has, which is to say capitalism is a social and historical problem that must be explained. And the great brilliance of the work is then to say, ironically, capitalism claims to be a society about property rights. This is the one great claim to fame it makes everywhere, that people get property rights in our capitalist society. And yet, says Marx, the condition for capitalism coming into our world was that millions of people had to be deprived of their property. Millions of people had to be separated from their land, had to be removed from it, had to be denied access to it. And that is the story in the first instance of the great enclosure movements in Great Britain, by which peasants were driven off the land, land was enclosed and privatized. And I would argue it is the story of the great racial enclosure movement that happens with Atlantic slavery and the dispossession of 12 million Africans from their land and their being transmitted to markets in the New World as commodities. So that process of dispossession, of being separated from property, maybe the property was communally owned, not personally owned, but it was nonetheless property in the sense in which it was means of life to which people had guaranteed access. And so the brilliance of Marx's story is to say, this society is odd and irregular. It is not transhistorical. It has not been around forever. And contrary to its own claims, it rests upon dispossessing millions of property. And in telling that story of dispossession, which is known today as either the story of primitive accumulation, an awkward translation from Marx's German, or sometimes, as David Harvey has put it, of accumulation by dispossession. Capital accumulates wealth by dispossessing those who labor and giving them no other means of survival except to enter into the market and to sell their wage labor. Now, there's much more to Marx's Capital, but I would argue that what I've covered there in terms of the mystery of commodities and the historic truth of dispossession makes Marx's work more profound in terms of understanding capitalism than anything else we have been gifted with.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by David McNally. He's the author of many books, including Monsters of the Market and Another World is Possible. And we're talking about the ideas of Karl Marx on the bicentennial of his birthday. I'm Sasha Lilly. David, we were talking about the ideas in Capital, and a decade earlier, before Volume 1 of Capital was published, Marx made extensive notes in a series of notebooks called the Grundrisse, or that's how we refer to it, which was not published until 1939. And the Grundrisse has evoked a lot of interest. To what degree do the ideas in the Grundrisse differ from those of Capital, and are the two works complementary? If we can talk about some large volume of writing about wide-ranging topics.
Yes, I do see the works as continuous or compatible, which is not to say, of course, that there aren't real differences. The Grundrisse is really a set of notebooks full of Marx's assessments of other thinkers. He often moves down different tangents as he's trying to clarify his own thinking about, say, money and its different historical forms and that sort of thing. It is has much more the character of personal notebooks than the very polished literary text that Capital Volume 1 is. But I think people have been drawn repeatedly back to the Grundrisse because it shows Marx's thought process, and it shows a whole series of commitments that I would argue ought to be clear from Capital Volume 1, but for many readers, for all kinds of historical reasons, were not clear. And in particular, and the thing which grabbed so many readers of the Grundrisse in the 1950s and 60s, is the continuous recurrence of Marx's discussion of alienation and alienated labor. That had been a primary category in Marx's early economic and philosophical manuscripts from 1844. And some commentators had argued, well, those youthful enthusiasms about disalienating labor and developing forms of worker self-management of disalienated labor, that all of this Marx later gave up as silly and youthful, and really he had become some kind of state socialist. And of course, you can see those whose loyalties were to the Soviet Union and so on often gravitated towards that sort of analysis. Therefore, they argued that Marx had abandoned these concerns with alienation. Well, all of a sudden, here was evidence repeatedly across the text that Marx was using the concept of alienation, and he was talking about the overcoming of alienated labor as, if you will, the fundamental task of socialist transformation of society. So I think that was hugely important to a lot of people. Now, I would argue, if you read Capital carefully, you can see all of those concerns there, particularly in the famous Section 4 of Chapter 1 on the fetishism of commodities. I think all of those concerns with alienation are clearly evident there. Also, something I was referring to earlier gets highlighted in these Grundrisse notebooks, and that's Marx's grasp of the technological dynamism of capitalism. You'd see him really developing an understanding that the competition among different capitalists and different sectors of capital forces a continuous process of innovation by which one capitalist develops new labor-saving technologies that will allow them to get a competitive edge, to produce the same commodity more quickly and therefore more cheaply with less labor time and less labor costs. And of course, what that does, and it gives it a huge contemporary relevance, is that raises the specter of ongoing automation within capitalism. And again, while I would say that's there in Capital, Marx spends a lot more time, because he's clarifying his own thinking, he spends a lot more time, therefore, emphasizing this technological dynamism, the continual replacement of workers by new forms of machinery and of older forms of machinery by new technologies. And so we get an image of capitalism which is very contemporary and very relevant to our current moment. It's fascinating to see a great social theorist at work in his own intellectual laboratory, and that's what we get there. So I don't think that there is anything in that text which is hugely inconsistent with Capital, but I think we get to see him working through problems. The other point I would make about it is it really reminds us of the open-endedness of Marx's thinking, the ways in which he saw every analysis as provisional and unfinished. Of course, we need to be able to understand the world in which we live to the greatest degree possible, with the fullest of our capacities. But we also need always to recognize the unfinishedness, the incomplete character of all analysis. And that's why, going back to a point we touched on earlier, those Marxist feminists who come along today and want to extend and develop Marx on gender and the family, those anti-racist Marxists who pick up some of Marx's scattered reflections on slavery and racism and develop them way more robustly than Marx ever did, I think are really in the spirit of Marx's commitment to ongoing experimentation and development of a living body of work, not a static set of principles and propositions sort of somehow meant for all time.
Let me ask you about Marx and a vision of life after capitalism. Marx cautioned about writing recipes for the cookbooks of the future, and yet his writings do indicate in different ways some key aspects of how he imagined people to be and the centrality of their liberation in a post-capitalist world. Yet it's very hard to read Marx and to think about Marx and life after capitalism without being pulled down by the baggage of history, because so much of the generalizations that are made about Marx and Marx thinking about life after capitalism are shaped by the disaster of the Soviet experience and so on. But reading Marx himself, what can we pick up on in thinking about life beyond capitalism?
That truly is a great question. And you're right that Marx's allergy to recipes for the future really came from that principle that the workers must discover for themselves the new social forms, the institutions that will be necessary to creating a free post-capitalist society. And therefore, it would be elitist arrogance for him to prescribe in advance what a future society ought to look like. But nevertheless, I think you're right that we can still draw a whole series of principles that are, if you will, give us the spirit, the ethos of what his thinking based on the working class struggles of his age that he was participating in, the principles that would logically follow from those. And so we've touched on one of those, which is disalienating labor. The idea that workers need to be subjected to authoritarian managerial control rather than being democratically self-organized and self-managing in places of work, I think that runs through Marx repeatedly and clearly is a, if you will, a guiding principle. Even if there's no cookbook there, it is a guiding principle that informs his work. I would say the same thing about all of the references to social cooperation within Marx. Marx is in that great socialist tradition of cooperativism. He imagines that human cooperation can be foundational to a social order, that a society does not need to be organized along principles and lines of market competition. And he talks repeatedly about this. While he didn't believe that it would be possible to incrementally transform capitalism by creating workers' cooperatives here and there, he thought that there was no way that you could break the rule of capital by creating a cooperative bike shop or a cooperative bookshop or what have you. He did nevertheless always say these are very instructive examples. They show us the capacities of workers to self-manage. And so cooperation and worker self-management, it seems to me, are absolutely central there. Similarly, Marx is very insistent on the idea that our social labor time ought to be radically reduced. He calls this the expansion of free time, the time, as he puts it, for free human self-development. Of course, every society is going to require that healthy, able-bodied people be contributors to meeting social needs, whether they're doing elder care, whether they are helping to construct housing, whether they're caring for children, whether they are helping with food servicing and food production. We're going to need people's labor. But, said Marx, we are going to try to use cooperative organization and the highest technologies available to us to radically reduce the time we spend engaged in social labor so that more and more of life becomes developmental and recreational, where we pursue our personal needs and interests unencumbered by the requirements of showing up to work 40 hours or more a week, 5 days a week for 40 some odd years of our lives. And then I would add finally that there is, to Marx, a great anti-colonial, anti-imperialist internationalism. That is why from the beginning he says things like the workers have no country, the workers have no fatherland. Marx's vision is that capitalism is becoming a global system, and the workers need to be even more globalist, even more internationalist in their outlooks. And therefore, this means overcoming all of the inequalities between nations as we move towards a true world community of people that doesn't lock any of us into national identities and national borders, but at the same time is respectful of cultural differences, which can be part of the great mosaic of a truly global society. So I think all of those values, or that ethos, as I said earlier, is there in Marx, and we need to insist upon it in the aftermath of the experiences of Stalinism historically. The development of the bureaucratic police state with one party in Russia did an immense historical disservice to socialism and to the whole of the socialist mission. And I think we can use Marx effectively to show that there is an entirely different socialist tradition that need not be complicit with that and need not be compromised by that Soviet experience.
I want to end by asking you, David, about the durability of capitalism since Marx's time. Marx certainly wrote about the dynamism of capitalism, but do you think that he underestimated its dynamism, that, you know, we still have capitalism 135 years after his death, after a time which seemed like an age of revolution that seems to have then ebbed?
I think that what Marx underestimated was the effects that capitalism's technological dynamism could have when exploited by dominant classes on the working class as a whole. Marx was fundamentally optimistic about the capacities of the working class to understand the world in order to change it. And I don't think that he was fundamentally wrong in that regard, but I think he simplified what has turned out to be a much more complex task. And you can see why in his own lifetime. In his own lifetime, he sees the working class socialist left go from mere circles to eventually building cross-border organizations with international aspirations. He sees mass movements. He sees the Paris Commune and workers actually seize power for over 70 days in Paris and so on. And so I think he saw a developmental trajectory of the working class growing ever more conscious of its situation and ever more organized in response to it. And I think what he didn't see, and it's difficult to blame him for this, but it's something that we need to see, is that capital can actually use moments of great social unrest and social instability to enormously restructure industry and capitalist production and to massively restructure the state and social life. And so obviously for us, the most pressing example of that is the way in which capitalism was able to restructure itself coming out of the social and political crises of the 1960s associated with the civil rights movement, black power, women's liberation, gay liberation in the United States, for instance, the massive general strike of 1968 in France, the hot autumn of factory occupations in 1969 in Italy, and then rolling into the 1970s with mass anti-war struggles and the great wave of wildcat strikes even inside the United States, for instance. And capitalism used an immense process of restructuring, which literally destroyed working class communities. The coal mining communities of Britain are basically gone. Many of the historic working class communities of the industrial Midwest in the United States are gone. The Bolivian tin miners' communities are overwhelmingly gone. And the disappearance of workplaces, of industries, is also the destruction of infrastructures of dissent, of those practices and institutional spaces where working class cultures were nourished and reproduced historically, where everybody knew of the great strikes that had been waged and traditions were passed on. And those processes of capitalist restructuring disorient the working class, and to use a category that some Italian Marxists have used, they decompose the working class. And so we get these cycles of decomposition, and then we try to enter into cycles of recomposition. And in those cycles of recomposition, the working class doesn't look the same as it once did. The kinds of workplaces it works in are different. The kinds of industries and technologies with which it operates are different. The social media, the technologies of everyday life, the practices of everyday life, the way working class communities are organized, all of this changes, and working class organization needs to change with it. And so I think Marx didn't foresee how restructuring could produce these cycles of decomposition. But I think at the same time, his immense confidence in the ability of working people to learn, to reorganize themselves, to get up from every nasty and brutal period and reorganize and resist and fight back. And I would again cite the teacher strikes that we've been seeing in the United States recently as a beautiful example of that. That confidence is something we need to hold on to. Yes, I think Marx simplified a much more complex social process. But that confidence is important because it allows us to hold to the idea that one of our tasks is to still contribute to clarifying the struggles of the age in ways that assist the self-organization of working class people today. And so even if we see Marx as having not attended to some of those complexities, I think we can see him as adhering to a fundamental confidence which represents a solidarity, a commitment to self-emancipation that, even if he died in 1883, remains a legacy which we can hold on to today, and which I think is important when we enter into a period of recomposition of working class struggles, which I think it is arguable we may have entered in recent years.
David McNally, thank you so much for your time today.
It's my pleasure, Sasha, as always.
I've been speaking with activist and professor of political science at York University, David McNally. He's the author of many books, including Against the Market. And in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that I've edited a book of David's, Global Slump, published by PM Press, which I'm connected with. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.